que la música mira también que pensé y fue de algo que metí a la chica que tiene una protección de información y todo just by way of presence of committee members, subcommittee members of the United States, other committee members that due to unforeseen circumstances have had to apologize and would not be here today. We did also notify those that presented yesterday. We should not regard it as an impediment in any way. The members that are here as few as they might be are sufficiently equipped to deal with your concern as presenters and involved. As few as they are, the control to interact with you on your concerns and on your presentation. By way of the notice to those that are going to participate today, we want to note that we have divided the session today into a morning session and an afternoon session. You were requested to either attend the morning session or the afternoon session, although you might find now that there is a detailed program. I would caution you that if you were asked to be here in the morning session, to make yourself available for the morning session, because if any presenter is late or does not come, you would be required, notwithstanding the fact that the program might say that you are to present at 9:30. Okay. You are required to present immediately. And we did this specifically to try and avoid delays when people were late or people did not turn up for the presentation. We try and stick as much program. Those of you that haven't seen it, you might now be able to look and see exactly where you are scheduled in the morning session. If you have been allocated an afternoon session, you might be able to see exactly what time. But as I say, please see that you are seated when the afternoon session starts, so that if you're required to be there earlier, you are going to be in a position to do so. We notified all the presenters that the procedure that was adopted the last time, and I take it in terms of the previous bill, most of you are veterans. We adopting the same procedure, and we notified that each presenter will be given 30 minutes to interact with the committee. 15 minutes we would allocate to you to do a presentation. Ask that you concentrate on your main point, or those points that you'd like to emphasize. I think you can take it for granted that the honorable members have all read very carefully gone through your presentation and they have all that information very clearly in their mind. It would not be necessary to repeat most of those things. What we would like to get out of this interaction the emphasis that you place on certain issues. And we'd like, during your presentation, 15 minutes that you concentrate on that. The other 15 minutes that makes up your half an hour, we would like to interact with the committee, give the committee members an opportunity to see clarity on some of your points. And I might just add lastly that we had a very profitable and valuable session yesterday, and I'm sure most of you have seen the presentations of the other presenters and the areas that have been raised as areas of concern. And so I'm not saying that those that are presenting today are at disadvantage and the committee is not likely to hear you, but we have covered sufficient a lot of ground yesterday on a whole range of concerns, ranging to the vagueness and the broadness of definition, the lack of the public interest defense, and all those things that many of you have raised in your presentation. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't raise it again, because that means become very familiar with it, some of the concerns that you have been raised. So, without much ado, questions will come later. We are going to go immediately over to Durban Legal Research Association. Association of Lawyers Arms. Always nice to have lawyers around. Very nice people. Are we going to hear from them? For 15 minutes, what they are say. After that, we will have the South African National Editors Forum panel. I understand they are led by Mr. Raymond Lowe, very well known to me, old timer. And thereafter, we will have SANCO. You all know SANCO, the South African National Civic Organization. And it should come into the proceedings. We will have tea then at 5 to 11 for 10 minutes, 5 past 11. Thereafter, immediately at 5 past 11, we will expect the print media of South Africa, Mr. Daniel Meyer, to take over. And thereafter, the Mainland Guardian will follow. Thereafter, the South African Communist Party. And thereafter, we will have lunch at 12:45. And finish at 1:25. At 1:30, we will immediately start with the National Archives and Records Service. I understand it's got a PowerPoint presentation. At 2:05, we will have Cusato. There will be a tea break at 2:35. According to 3, we will have the Mail and Guardian Investigative Journalism, Mr. Stefan Brummer. The South African Human Rights will follow at 3:20. And then there will be a session where everybody will be allowed for a short while to interact on the day's proceedings. We are likely to close around about 4:30 if all goes well. Everybody be lazy, start on time. I think that's what we aim to do. Urban research. I'm on time, you on time. Okay, you might, as you go along, just introduce yourself and your delegation. Everybody comes from a little bit easier.
Thank you very much, Professor. My name is Linda Kama, and I represent the Legal Research Association, which is a group of interested legal researchers, particularly because a number of us were involved in drafting principles for a democratic South Africa. So there has been an interest in tracking down what is happening by way of legislation. So this bill is of interest to us, particularly because
excuse me, Mr. Jacob, you just asked the lawyer to speak in the mic.
Sorry. Okay. So what we are saying is that this bill is of interest to us because South Africa at present, compared to the rest of the continent, is sailing ahead in that rights are enshrined. For instance, the right to know, the right to information, is enshrined in the Bill of Rights, which means that it is justiciable. At the same time, what concerns us is that while our country has quite a democratic constitution, it is a fairly advanced constitution, so far the rights are actually sitting in the constitution. They are not cascading down to be experienced by ordinary people. In addition to that, our country, we concede, has an act, you know, PAYA, which was promulgated in 2000. Even that promotion of that information is not cascading to ordinary people. So as lawyers, we felt that we also need to make our voice heard, particularly because we represented, during the old days, we represented the ordinary of the ordinary and the poorest of the poor. And we are concerned that even now the pattern of actually leaving the poorest of the poor is being perpetrated. This is a very sophisticated interaction right now as we are present. There are journalists, there are professionals, there are organizations of literate and professional people. The truth of the matter is that there are millions and millions of people out there who don't even know that such a bill exists. During the build-up, which led to the adoption of our constitution in 2006, democratic lawyers literally simplified the law. They literally took it to remote corners of this country. It's hard work. That is why we end up with a Rolls Royce constitution. But the beauty of it is that people understood what the constitution was about. We were in halls, dingy halls. It's easy for South Africa to end up again with rights that are shrouded in secrecy if certain things are done. And this brings us to this bill. We concede that when we look at more than 85 countries all over the world, South Africa is actually coming top, and that is beautiful. We're very proud of that. Having said that, we are aware that we cannot compare South Africa to third world countries, highly developed countries, and all democracies. But beauty, again, is that when we look at Sweden, Sweden started by opening all the gates, if I could use that expression, but they are now narrowing the gates because of certain problems that have arisen. Same thing with Ireland. Ireland has a very, very liberal access to information legislation. However, there are certain challenges. The beauty is India, because in 2005, India, you know, is the country that actually was pushed to open up access to information. It came from the ground. And I would very much like us to look at the Indian experience. I would like us to look at the Swedish experience. I would like us to look at the Irish experience, including the Canadian experience. Regrettably, back home in our continent, there is very little comparative analysis that one can do. Yours truly has been in East Africa for the last 3 years. So far, there isn't an experience that I can draw to say South Africa can actually look at, because we are sailing ahead. The difficulty with this book is as follows. I'll just like to skim through before my time is up. There are certain provisions that are vague and embarrassing here. For instance, in Chapter 5, there are expressions like the public good. What is the public good? I'm just using an example of wide phrases that can be anything. Another difficulty that one faces, that we face, with this book, Chapter 4, and I'm going to be explicit. If, as a lawyer, one reads Section 12 five times, and one says, what are they saying here? What that means is that perhaps there is a challenge with draftsmanship here. Chapter 4, that is Section 12 of Chapter 4, needs a lot of tweaking. Or, if it has to be scrapped, let it go, because one is asking, what are they saying here? What is the intention here? That shouldn't happen in such a proposed legislation, because it is supposed to be crisp. Why should it be crisp? It should be crisp because Section 32 of the Constitution provides that everyone has the right of access to A, any information held by the state, and B, any information that is held by another person. This is another cap, by the way. I mean, it's a feather on our cap that we stretch rights right up to information that is held by a private person. And that's unique to South Africa, by the way. So Section 32 of the Constitution is very, very powerful. So what this says is that if there is any right that is protected, it should, if it is challenged, the state should be able to explain, or a governing body should be able to explain why that right is prescribed or limited. So any limitation is supposed to be crisp and sharp and focused. So there are certain clauses that are rather too wide. And let us go further and look at... I've been first to speak about this. Clause 12 of Chapter 4, that needs a lot of tweaking. And I've alluded to the public good. That is vague and embarrassing, actually. We then go to what is problematic again. It is a very strong flavor of the agency. With respect to the agency, particularly because of where we are coming from, a strong involvement of the agency is going to drive people underground. For instance, there are very, very strong penal provisions here. And because the penal provisions are very, very strong, the bill should make sure that there is certainty. Why I have contravened the law, A, B, C, D, and I'm going to be punished, because the penal provisions are very, very heavy. So heavy to such an extent that, I think maybe the lawyers are going to make a lot of money, but with respect, I don't think that the intention in this country is to make lawyers rich, particularly because it's very expensive to go to court. What should happen here is a redrafting and a sharpening of certain provisions so that, number one, they are in harmony with PAYA, they should be in harmony with the Constitution, and I would like to add another legislation that is going to help, because there are concerns, justifiably so, about tender rigging and the corruption that is surfacing in this country. That is, the antitrust legislation is going to assist. What we are suggesting here is that this bill, as it is, will not cure, even if it were to go back to the drawing board, and it should go back to the drawing board, but it will not cure the corruption that is emerging when it comes to tender rigging. What needs to be done, which is also constitutionally aligned, is that the competition law of this country needs to be sharpened so that collusion, whether it is by officials or by whoever, when it comes to public tenders that are contravening the PMFA, something has to be done, and we are of the view, we submit that the Competition Act will also be of assistance to actually cure this evil. And finally, we would like to see South Africa protecting whistleblowers. We would like to see South Africa, that is another mechanism. We do not see that here. Whistleblowers in this country must be protected, and they must also be protected from prosecution. If the criminal, if Section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act has to go, it has to go in order to open this country that is so beautiful, democratic, but grappling with actually making the Constitution tick. That is grappling with making the right to information tick. so that there is socio-economic justice right at the lowest level of society. I thank you for this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, you've heard the presentation. I recognize the Honourable Bond is here, while the other members are figuring out what to ask. Honourable Bond, you may proceed.
My thank you, Chairperson, and our appreciation for the both the submission and the input this morning, and the opportunity to greet Ms. Sama. We agree with you that our access to information must be improved. And the mechanism for doing that would be to either improve PAIA or to improve PAIA's implementation. Unfortunately, that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the protection of information, so, which is another instrument altogether. So that's just by way of comment. You referred to Section 32 of the Constitution and its wonderful provision for the right to access to information. And now I come to my question. Is this right? And all the other rights contained in the Constitution, are they absolute?
No.
No. Right. Should our rights to access to information be such that even foreign agents, criminal syndicates, who don't share our interests, can have the same access to information as law-abiding citizens of this country?
No.
Okay. Then my last question to you, is there a need for this instrument that is before us today, which deals with the protection of classified public records?
Could you repeat the last question?
Is there a need for legislation that is before us today that deals with the protection and regulation of classified public records?
There is, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam, Honourable Lawless has asked you the necessity of the Bill for Protection of Public Information. As a lawyer, how do you see what type of information this bill tries to protect? You as a legal person, how will you see what type of information? Because the man in the street is battling with the perception of the information portion of it, the classification of information. And he feels that everything is going to be classified. How do you see it as a lawyer?
One of the reasons I said it's important for this bill to be debated further is precisely because, let us take a simple example. Information that is within defense of this country. That's public information, it's sensitive, and it's understandable if it is classified and protected. I don't think anybody should just have access to that information. And secondly, when it comes to matters of national security, unless we are a banana country, we cannot just open everything, right? So there is information. Let me give an example. Many people, even I think all of us who are here, would like to know what happened until 1994. There is information we were not even allowed to have access to that information must be opened up so that there is a story. It is our story. It must be told. And I know that ordinary people would like to know in their languages, not in English, in their languages, what happened, what was happening, so that it doesn't happen again.
Thank you, to everyone here. In your statement, you said, I think our question is, I don't remember that, any information by the state and any information by the private person should be accessed. Are you aware that South Africa is the only country in the world that does not have any mechanism or laws of regulation information? And you think we should go on like that? But secondly, as you presented, you mentioned parts of India or part of those countries. Countries like UK, Singapore, Australia, and Canada have official citizens that allow access of information, and they'll say in defense of their public, which they're defending in their countries. And as you know, explanation is the order of the day, whether it comes from media, comes from where. So, what is your take on that? What do you think?
Thank you very much. Our focus is, we are not saying the whole of the story. We understand the principle. Yes, the UK, MI6, you know, you don't get anything there. So there is, actually, it is fairly secretive. If one compares Ireland and the UK, you know, at least Ireland come up, it's better than the UK. There is a need for such a book, particularly because we cannot use the old legislation. You know, the 1982 Act, you know, cannot be used. What we are saying is that let us select what are exceptions like this, and the other information, you know, should be open to the public. And secondly, it's going to be important so that there is a check and a balance. Let us have an information commission or a tribunal so that, you know, if, for instance, yours truly appeals to the minister that, you know, I requested this information and your department has declined, you know, it doesn't make sense to appeal to the minister. First of all, they are very busy. And bureaucracy has taught that if you are lucky, I'm sorry to say, if you are lucky in South Africa, it takes 6 months to get a response. And it is a shame. So let there be an independent tribunal where there will be a specification that, you know, you appeal, you get an answer within 30 days, for instance, or within a stipulated time. So that I can then run to that tribunal and say, 30 days is up. I haven't received an answer. This is what was said here. Yeah.
Good morning. And to the honorable members and all visitors, I'll still remain in South Africa even if anything can happen. I think to be exposed in this bill, in the whole process, it's really taking us back to what you said before. That whether we pass this bill or not, we will need a serious workshop that you do on Facebook. I wouldn't want to say we are empty, but we are new in this type of democracy. And we are doing, my mother used to do petrol products. You are cutting here, you are testing there. We see what are better and you are making it much more better. But it is helping us because right now we are exposed to some things that we never thought. Sundu Kombe Sunduza is putting questions in the settings. But I'm happy this time that because the drafters are here. It begins to address the issue of us public representatives. When the presenter is talking about tender, we can't just ignore it. Because that's what we found at the ground. When people begin to fight and ask questions, they have to be protected somehow in this. Whistleblowers, these are issues that we are always faced with in during our constituency work. So I'm not going to be asking questions about this presentation. Instead, I want to say, let us enjoy the freedom that you made to come during our lifetime, so that we correct what is ours thoroughly. Also, I want to move into thanking. I'm really thankful because yesterday we were listening a lot of good information, but there was nothing even saying anything about Africa. At least we know now that when we talk of benchmarking, we can't be deceiving ourselves by going to countries that don't have anything that we'd be looking for. If India is the best, we need to, during our lifetime in this democracy, we look to know what makes them to be best. If Sweden is mentioned, we need to know, but we need to begin to implement what our constitution and other structures of authority are saying. What makes Africa not to have such things? Because we can be far advanced as south on the tip, but if the whole continent is down in terms of what we are talking about, what is the constitution saying about that? The last point that I want to I've said that at the beginning, that we need a lot of education. Lot of education as the masses of this country that fought for this democracy and fought for this constitution. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think what the Honourable Member is saying is that the committee is listening. He's grateful for the presentation. You are bringing valuable insight into particularly background information, and perhaps what the feelings outside there are regarding the Kulana. That's what the Honourable Member is trying to. It doesn't warrant a response if you don't want to, it's merely a comment. The Honourable, could see, I saw your light flicker there where you returned to the chair. You want him to say something?
I'd just like to and follow up on my first question to the presenter. To answer my question in referring to information already being classified before 1994, my question was, how do you see it, the classification of information under this bill? How is it going to influence the man in the street? Taking into account there's a vast difference between defense information, spoke security information of the country, and comparing it with normal information that belongs to the man in the street, not personal information, but information that he needs day to day. I'd like to answer that, and then, fortunately or unfortunately, you're not the only one that creates the impression by myself. There's other representatives that's coming later today that also got that impression that this bill will immediately declassify all information before 1994. Because, as in your own words, you said that's the people's story. But you must also take into account that, and ask yourself the question, would it be in the interest of the safety of this country to declassify all the information before 1994? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I hope I got your question, the first one, crisply this time. The point about opening information, particularly what I would consider to be the information that is not sensitive, your defense, your national security, etc. The reason for that is because rights are not just rights. You know, this is the information that is going to be a tool, that should be, not is going, it should be a tool to socio-economic advancement of ordinary people. When people do not know they don't even understand the value of the piece of information that they need, that it will influence a right, for instance, an economic right, a social right. They don't know. So far, there is a lot of ignorance. When we are looking at information, I'm coming from that angle, that the right, this information, is then going to strengthen social rights and economic rights. And that is why it's got to be simplified, it's got to be taken to people so that they know and they can leverage for social and economic justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. And let me thank the speaker for her eloquence in dealing with this bill. I think a lot of effort was done in carrying this bill. And it was not prepared by us, by lawyers, just like yourself. And I think they have done a lot of research also. Dr. has done a lot of research in dealing, in changing the 1982 Act to make a transformative deal. And I think you granted that. Though we are traversing a new terrain in moving forward, but I think we have to understand that we are trying to move away from the 1982 Act, and we are making amendments so that it suits the conditions, the new conditions in South Africa. Now, where there is a lot of crime, where there is a lot of things that cannot just be open to everybody, where there is a lot of threats from enemies of the state who would like to move us backward. Now, so I think you should take that into consideration, that the national security critical paramount in the country, and whether we open up, but we have to open up with that being weary of the fact that there are a lot of enemies who wouldn't like South Africa moving forward and improving development. Thank you.
I fully concede that the drafters of this bill are lawyers who are committed to moving away from the 1982 Act. Having said that, it is the culture, it is in the culture of lawyers to actually, you draft, even if you give your draft to, you can come up with 20 drafts. That is what we do, so that at the end of the day, we come up with a draft that reflects the intention of those we are drafting for. So what we are saying here is that, yes, we are in the right direction. However, this bill needs further sharpening. And it does need further sharpening, because the concern is that those who have money are going to be taking the relevant ministries to court. There are certain matters here that would make lawyers rich, and we don't want that. That's number one. Number two, we would like such legislation to make sense even to ordinary people. So I conceive that the learned colleagues have done a good job. You know, it's just that they will understand that there has to be further sharpening and further consultation and vibrancy about it, and we'll be happy. Thank you.
Well, I think really well said that. I think we are going to end this presentation. We've run over by 1.5 minutes. But I think it was worthwhile. Thank you very much. I think the Honourable Fichler point is made. Lawyers are not always the best people to tell the public out there in very nice, simple words what it is that is expected of them. I think that's the point that the presenter is making. So we might be a little bit more consumer friendly in these words, so that people out there to whom the law is going to apply actually understand it in a better sense. I think that point was well made. So thank you very much for coming here. And I think we are going to go immediately over to SANEF, the South African National Heritage Forum.
Thank you, Chair. Listen, my name is Henry Jeffrey. I'm Deputy Chairperson of the South African National Heritage Forum. We want to thank you for receiving our submission and also for this opportunity this morning to make further presentations based on this submission. Our delegation consists, as you earlier mentioned, of Raymond Lowe, who will do the further representation, and in fact, two other colleagues, Thabo Lashilo, who is chairperson of our Media Freedom Committee, and Mondli Makanya, who is a council member of SANEF. So without further ado, I will hand over to Mr. Lowe to make his submission. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. We thank you very much indeed for this opportunity to make our representations before this committee. I don't think that I need to explain what SANEF is. We've mentioned this before in previous representations to parliamentary committees, but I think it's generally known that where our interest is focused on freedom of information, the access to information, and the maximum dissemination of information. Now, as to this bill, our concerns, as outlined in our submission, relate firstly to the changes that have been made in the bill since the original was brought before this committee. And what concerned us there was the fact that the safeguards, or should I say the softening features of that bill to enable people to exercise caution as to the kind of material that is classified, have been largely removed, and that this has tightened the state's grip on maintaining the secrecy of information. And it also has extended the powers of politicians over the classifying of information. We're very, very worried indeed that those cautionary remarks, such as a statement that state information is not automatically protected against disclosure, state information should be made available to the public unless there are good reasons to withhold it. We can't understand why those clauses, which are very good clauses in the sense of saying be careful what you do before you classify information, that those clauses have been removed from this bill, the new bill. We believe that the result is an overemphasis on the need for information to be protected. There's another clause which states that there should be an initial, at least the original classifiers must provide a written justification for each initial classification decision, which we think is a very sensible approach to the question of classification. Now, this has been removed. There is no reference to the need for original classifiers having to provide written justification for their decisions. And we believe that the removal of this safeguard means that the application of classification can be abused, as there is no record of the reasons which could be subject to the oversight of a senior official. There's also the question of declassification instructions being placed on any document which is classified. This too has been removed, and we do not again understand why such a cautionary statement, which could apply to the declassification of information, should be removed from the bill. There's another statement in the original which says an exceptional measure. A classification is an exceptional measure and should be used sparingly. We think that that's a very good cautionary statement. The word sparingly has been removed, so it merely says that it's an exceptional measure. That means that, again, there's an overemphasis on the need to protect information. There is also, in the original version, if there is significant doubt as to whether information requires protection, it should not be classified. We like that because it's very close to what newspapers operate on. If in doubt, leave out. And what they're saying there in the original is the information, if there's doubt about classifying information, it should not be classified. But under the new version, it should not be classified. It's replaced with the matter must be referred to the minister for a decision. This introduces political decision making to what should be a decision based on proper and factual criteria. And in fact, it overrides doubt. There was reference in earlier questions about the automatic declassification of material which was classified before May 10, 1994. This declassification appears. This has now been removed. It removes the automatic declassification of material which was classified before May 10, 1994. And we think that this is also an unhappy step. We're also worried about the introduction of a statement which is that classification decisions can relate to disclosure of information of an intelligence or law enforcement investigative measure. The concerns here are of the undesirability of maintaining secrecy over investigative measures and the fact that maintaining secrecy over such activity may give rise to abuse, such as covering up torture as an investigative measure, especially as it is dedicated to protecting the national interest. We are also worried indeed about the way a new section has been added to the bill, extending the powers of the Minister of State Security, which states that the Minister may, after taking into consideration all aspects of the survival and security of the state and the pursuit of justice, democracy, economic growth, free trade, a stable monetary system, and sound international relations, together with the consideration of the benefits of secrecy and the aspects of information protection and disclosure, authorize the classification or declassification of any category or class of classified information. We're very worried that there should be a view that classification of information should become a political instrument, as it would be in the hands of a political person such as the minister. We are concerned of the excessive powers this section devolves on the minister. It virtually transcends all other aspects in the bill, and it questions whether in such a sensitive area, a political person should be able to wield such power. It should also be borne in mind that the scope the bill gives the minister is extremely wide. It relates to the national interest, which itself covers almost every facet of activity in South Africa. In effect, it is authorizing the minister to decide what information on almost every conceivable subject should be withheld from South Africans. And by using his powers of declassification, he can select what information should become public property. One of our concerns here is that he may be called the protector of state information, which we think would be a very unfortunate name to be given to a minister of state. And of course, that will very easily transform itself into a chief censor. We believe that one should take into account Cameron Commission of Inquiry finding, which it was an investigation which was held in 1994, and the Cameron Commission of Inquiry was appointed to investigate illegal arms dealing and particularly the sale of weapons to Yemen, a country to which South Africa was not allowed to sell arms under government policy. The commission was headed by Judge Edwin Cameron, and it became known as the Cameron Commission. He is now a judge on the Constitutional Court. He was very taken with the thought of the classification of information which the Defense Department was very keen to keep classified. There was a document which was called Log 17. This document listed the countries to which South Africa was able to sell arms. The Commission wished, as part of its policy of openness, to refer to Log 17 in public. It wanted to make reference to that particular document in public. The South African National Defence Force objected and launched an application for secrecy in regard to this document. But the Commission ruled that it would release the documents. But the interesting part about that whole process is the reasons given by Mr. Justice Cameron as to why that document should be released, and I think it goes to the heart of the problems that are associated with this bill. He said, reasonableness as a standard of public conduct in South Africa now requires that decision makers should have due regard to appropriate constitutional standards and principles. These include, in the present case, the value of openness and visibility in government and official processes. In other words, an assessment whether the reasonable justification test has been fulfilled may include in the weighing process giving consideration to the public's constitutional right to know and the constitutional value of an open society. To put the matter differently, the public's right to know should not be omitted from an assessment whether the reasonable justification standard has been fulfilled. He said the Defence Force had argued in support of its application to keep Log 17 from public scrutiny, that diplomacy in arms transactions requires a measure of secrecy, and he said this argument is rejected. It is precisely that secrecy that may create the conditions for subterfuge, duplicity, abuse of power, corruption, malpractice, and irresponsibility. The right of the public, where reasonable and practicable to know, must therefore be asserted. Mr. Chairman, I have gone less than my 15 minutes because I think I have dealt with the main issues as we were required to do, that you requested us to do. And I'm now open to questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those honourable members. The Honourable Kutsi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very easy one. The Honourable Sir mentioned a lot of concerns and worry about clauses that have been excluded from this new bill or the new sort of version of it. But would you recommend that they've been re-included in the document?
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, sir, because I think that they are very cautionary statements to a person who's engaged in the classification of information. We think that it will give a person pause to think, a person who has that task and that duty, pause to think very carefully before classifying the document. And we would support the reintroduction of those phrases. Thank you.
Honourable Sitton. Thank you.
And thank you for the recent statement. I've just got a few questions. One, the constitution, as it's been outlined, it really states that it is elected in parliament. It has an obligation to protect South Africa and its citizens and all the aspects. And now, if we we're not fulfilled with those obligations, such as protecting information is part of it. I hear you are very worried about the classification of information. As in the media industry. The other thing is this bill is trying to criminalize the activities. There are the information peddler about them, you know. And our obligation as well as government is to unite and harmonize the people of South Africa. And if these false information are coming out, and you know what I'm talking about, how do you say which information should be classified? Because now we are quoting, I defense a lot. Of the UK, the US, you will never write anything or get anything about their defense, their intelligence, and their state security. Are you saying now there must be just free flow in South Africa of anything that comes? I understand you, and as much as you want information to it on public interest, what about the rights of the people that you are violating as you write on print media, as you publish something? I just want to get it from you.
I think the whole tenor of our constitution is towards openness. Openness of our government practices and of our society. And there is one particular clause in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, which talks about the need for the state to respect, protect, and promote and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. And one of the rights that should apply to is the full Section 16, which is the freedom of expression. So what this Constitution is saying is that there should be the maximum amount of information available to the public. One understands there will be a need for classification, but I'm always reminded, when I come to that issue, of having met the Swaziland Defence Minister on one occasion, and I asked her about secrecy provisions in Swaziland, and that, for instance, and I said, what about the publication of the figures relating to the defence budget? She said, how can we publicise that? That will give our enemies access to information about our defence system. But of course, it's important for the information about the defence budget, not necessarily in great detail, but certainly the overall figure relating to the defence budget, to be published, so that the public should know what has been done in its name. That general approach, that is, that there should be the maximum amount of information available to the public, so that the public can in fact participate in the processes of government and oversee what government is doing in its name, and that is the important factor.
Honourable Mbowan, some clarity on the answer, and the Honourable Mkabadeli is next at the
answer. If I can just make a quick follow-up on what I'm saying now on openness. Every president has been speaking about openness, because I think as much as openness could the constitution, how far is the limit of openness? Because one can abuse the constitution and say it's openness. You know, I just wanted an understanding of openness and freedom of expression. I made an example yesterday to one president about freedom of expression was in freedom of expression in the constitution. An artist, I'll make an example, recently has painted the corpse of Nelson Mandela. And in his argument, he says, it's my freedom of expression through art. So these are other things, because the same constitution is saying that we must respect the dignity of other people. It must also protect me as a human being. That's why I'm worried about openness, because people just say openness. Now we must be open to everything. And that's because this bill, the intention also, is also to protect you as a citizen, protect you as a person. I just want to understand what level of openness must be
educated. I don't think that I can properly answer the question of what level of openness the government should decide to apply to information. All I can say is that I believe that it should be the maximum amount of openness. The principles of openness in regard to security information and classification of information was discussed in 1996 by a group of lawyers, both international and South African lawyers, at a conference at a game lodge north of Johannesburg. And they came up with a set of principles called the Johannesburg Principles. And what the way the broad approach to that was that they adopted on that conference was that they, when secrecy was being applied, it should be defined as narrowly as possible, so that it should there shouldn't be a broad approach to the question of applying secrecy. It should be limited as far as possible in accordance with the broad outlines of the Constitution. Now, those principles, as far as I know, have not been applied to this legislation. To answer your question, what degree of openness there should be, I can't tell you. All I can say is I want to see the maximum. And not only that, not only for my benefit, but for the benefit of the public of South Africa, which should have the maximum access. Now, I have not compared these proposals in this bill with those that apply to other countries. Another submission has in fact done that very well, and that's the one from the Open Society and the Institute for Security Studies, where they have indicated that there are other countries which in fact have a higher degree of openness in regard to the classification of information, much higher degree of openness than we have. And I haven't had the opportunity of making those comparisons, but I support the general contentions made in that comparison, and maybe that will go some way to answering your question, ma'am.
I'm just Honourable Long, the Honourable Capitelli was next, and then the Honourable Tifa. Are you seeking clarity on what was being said, or can I put you in the queue? Honourable Fickler, the Honourable Gabatelli first. I don't want to fall out of the Honourable Gabatelli. She was first, and I shall recognize you as soon as we finish with her, you next, and then the Honourable Lander. Okay.
Chair, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to the presenter. You know, I took time to read this presentation. I was at home. If you take your first 3 pages, I won't talk about the others. The last one I won't talk about. When you take your first 3 pages, it's the person who is not serving in that field that you're talking about. See this presentation as a comparative study of the bill that was and was withdrawn. And it leaves one who is like me, who are not in that bill, not to understand what was marked in that bill that these presenters are really crying about. So I want to support Honorable Kut. If we can get that bill so that we can really be together in understanding those good points that they are saying. Two, for me, it left a lot of accountability. It talks of broad range of coverage, as if we are not sure that our country is broad. It is broad. It might take time to cover this broadness, but it is there because the country now is broad. It's really inclusive of all the who live in it. So I've been reading and I'm coming up. You are not the only one. There were others also. I'm coming across the campaign about this broadness, as if it's not right for the country to be broad. I need assistance there. We can't cut our country to be narrow so that we can finish all that is needed. The other thing that doesn't show the mandate and who is accountable is only a third paragraph. You are talking about no, that paragraph is not about accountability, it's about clarity. These softening features, again, is because I was not sitting in that. What are these softening features that are not here, that were there? They were softening who for one, you know. Then the leaning heavily towards control of information. Let us be clear about this leaning. The control of information, how is that information related to the dictates of the Constitution? Because it's important. It's important. We shouldn't just take it in another way. All that you're saying should be based on the Constitution. How are these lineages doing what the presenters first it's necessary to highlight. When you are saying in your paragraph, last paragraph, you are saying that information should be made available to the public unless there are good reasons to withhold. Who has the authority to say these are good reasons? Because in the past, really, no one was involved except a few people. So who is this one who would be perfect in saying these are good reasons? That's accountability, because if we can continue and continue without being accountable, who choose who? The implication of prophesying. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs. They are saying SANEF recognizes that there are certain types of information relating to national security which must be protected. But a kind of professing to be a democracy with an open. Give me clarity of what made you to choose the professing part of it. Yeah, I think let me end there. But I read it so well and I've got so many remarks which I need clarity. Not that I'm saying, but it's not showing me that you are making the Constitution, you are really guided by the Constitution, whether we are lawyers or we are thieves or this. It confused me. And I will need to be taken back. It less accountability, it less the mandate. Because when you are complaining about the minister and the president, I thought that is the best way of showing that there is democracy. Because the minister was chosen as a minister because people voted him in. But this that is spread all over to say some people can appoint. Where are they according to who? When they go wrong, who will be called to say this person of yours is wrong? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. I have not dealt with the broad question of the national interest versus the national security, because I think you have heard over on that score, and in fact it's contained in my submission, in my broad submission, and I didn't feel that I wanted to belabor the point. But it is very clear that this bill, in dealing with the national interest as a reason for imposing classification, has broadened the concepts of the protection of information which could harm the security of the state to extremely wide proportions, which in fact cover virtually every activity, not only of the government, but of the society as a whole. And I think that those considerations are very, very worrying indeed, because you have mentioned, ma'am, the question of being a broad society. That is very true, but that doesn't mean to say that we should extend our quest for secrecy of protect information which could harm the society by extending it into that very broad field. I think that could be very dangerous. And I think that there should be a very careful assessment of the question of national security as being the prime factor and not national interest. On the question of the need for openness, I think I have indicated that I believe that the public should be informed to the maximum about what goes on, because that is the way a democracy, a functioning democracy, works.
And surprised at the success of the study in dealing with crime. Dark Lord and the Inquisitor coming. This is surprising. Because of classification trying to classify that is top secret. This diocese is top secret. This one is secret. This one is confidential. And therefore, we're able to deal effectively with that. That's why we intend soccer tournament was successful. So, this stability, because of that, otherwise, we have done that. We're not able to expose now those who wanted to destabilize South Africa. We do not consider having a good tournament, soccer tournament. I think it was because of that, those changes that were made. Now, we're putting laws now to tighten up that, so that in future we must have a peaceful South Africa after even that is what you have to understand. The condition, same conditions since 1996 that have happened in South Africa. We're never aware that we'll have syndicates in South Africa. Never aware that we'll have people who are doing heist. We're hiding things. People killing, even killing police. But we have to tighten up the law to deal with that situation. And what are the things? I think that's the matter.
I'm very concerned about that statement, sir. You are implying, if I read you correctly, that in fact there will be more and more secrecy, because what our attitude was in 1996 was that we were not aware of the, as fully aware as we should have been, of the possible constraints that government may have to place on information, and therefore we were a much more open society. But now, as we progress in our democracy, we are finding it necessary to become more and more secretive. And I think, sir, if I'm reading you correctly, that would be a very unfortunate approach to this whole question of secrecy. I understand you saying about the need to maintain secrecy over the methods of the police in dealing with crime. But once those methods have been broken and have appeared, and the public have become aware of them, there is no need to continue to impose those secretive classifications. And that's another concern that I have, that there is this legislation places categories of classification of information that could be already in the public domain.
I didn't want to step the student, but there's a question, you can leave other questions. That is where it says protected by the country, professing to be a democracy. What does it mean by professing? So that I can understand you are preparing a bit if we are not what you say we are. I need clarity from him.
I use the term professing a democracy because that is what we profess. We are a democracy, and we continually state that we are a democracy. And in a democracy, we should behave like democrats. And democratic processes should be as open as possible. And that's what, more or less what I was trying to convey by using the term professing, and professing democracy.
The Honourable Anders, it is your turn, and you will be the last one in the session.
Thank you, Chairperson. In the main, I agree with the submission by Mr. Lowen Fenech. For that, because some of the issues raised are crisp, and as in other submissions, we can at least grapple with the points raised. I do have a difficulty, though, with the issue slow rates about the Johannesburg principles. Mr. Lowe says the principles are not included in his own series. Criticism, which begs the question, then, what obligates us to include these principles in the law? ask this question for the following reason. The Johannesburg principles were first brought to our attention when we asked for and received written submission on this book. Until then, we weren't aware that these principles existed. And the Johannesburg principles have been raised as though the entire world ought to know about them, including us, which we did not. We're now informed by that a group of lawyers, and I'm sure they are honorable women and men, who met at some vague venue outside Johannesburg, and after their deliberations reached certain conclusions called the Johannesburg Principle. Now, we heard from Ms. Zummer that when we as elected public representatives embark on consideration of an instrument of this nature, we should consult as widely as possible. Indeed, the Constitutional Court now obligates us to do so, and we try to do so. Here we have a group of lawyers who met quietly, nobody knew that they were meeting, came up with these Johannesburg principles, and now suddenly we are expected to go around with these principles, though they're very, very important. We've received a copy of the principles yesterday. I've yet to see what they say. I've no doubt that they will be worthwhile and probably worth looking at with the intention of including them in the bill. But I don't think it's fair to accuse us of not including the principles in the bill when we don't know anything about these principles. So that group of lawyers should have also done what the Constitutional Court obliges us to do and consulted as widely as possible. And if they had done that, perhaps we would have looked at the Johannesburg principles and who knows, we might have included it in the book. But thus far, I know about the principles, I've not seen them. So, there you have it. And I'd really like your response to that.
I was a part of that meeting, actually. Not as a lawyer, but as a journalist. One of our complaints about this bill is has been the lack of consultation with stakeholders. We understand that not everybody should be consulted, obviously, but that certainly people with a with an interest in this particular field should be consulted. And one of the factors that we have noticed on this particular issue is that there was no attempt to consult SANEF, or the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or the Freedom of Expression Institute, people who deal with information and its dissemination, gathering of information and its dissemination. And we're very worried about that. And if they had been that, I'm talking now before the bill was drafted or while the drafting was going on, that there was no attempt to consult, as far as we know anyway, with stakeholders on the content of the bill. And had that taken place, then the Johannesburg principles, I have no doubt, would have been brought before the attention of the drafters. It wasn't, I can't recall who was the organizers. I think it was an international organization. I think it was Amnesty International that held the conference, and it was held in South Africa because it was felt that it would be valuable for South Africa to be part of such a discussion, having come from a closed society situation with the apartheid government. And it was felt that here was an opportunity to help open the society. And that's why the conference was held. I'm not so much concerned that the principles are not included in the bill. What I worry about is that no notice was taken, and you have confirmed that, sir, of the principles in the Johannesburg principles. And the main thrust of those were that there should be, when one is classifying information, a concentration on narrowing the areas of closing up information, because it's very important for a democracy to have as open society as possible. I think the venue, I can't state why the venue was chosen to be a game park north of Johannesburg, but I think it was close to Johannesburg, yet outside the worrying interferences that could happen if the conference was held in Johannesburg. I think that may answer the question, sir. Thank you.
Honourable members, we are running out of time on this issue. And I've got a lot of hands now. We've got to be careful here, otherwise we're going to have a vote. The Honourable Manius has shown, and he indicated he'd like to ask a question, and he has not had an opportunity. I want to first confirm with him that his question is going to be short before I allow that, and it's not going to be a long what's the name. Yes, I'll get to you. Let me just satisfy the Honourable Mania that I'm going to give him an opportunity. I'll get, as soon as the Honourable Mania is finished, I'll get back to you, Honourable Landers. Do you want clarity on what has been said?
Okay. Chair, through you to Mr. Lowe, but would you not agree then that that group of men did exactly what you are accusing government of doing? Because government drafts legislation, and you're saying government didn't consult the Senate, all right? I concede that should have been done, and it wasn't done. Then this group of men and women went to the game farm in Johannesburg without consulting widely as to who should attend, and came up with these principles, which is exactly what you're accusing government of doing. It was an exclusive group of people that deliberated with their own little ideas and came up with the Johannesburg principle, which was just as wrong.
My impression was that there were certain government officials invited to that, but my recollection going, I don't have the document in front of me. You have the document now. You could in fact see who were the people who attended that conference. But of course, they were not drafting legislation. They were holding a meeting at which they were propounding ideas and presenting those ideas to the public at large to take account of them. It's not quite the same as the drafters of this bill not consulting widely. People held meetings all over the place all the time at which they put forward ideas and then they publicized them. It's a normal function of society. The process is important is that the fact that those ideas were in fact canvassed, and they were canvassed just at a venue which happened to be convenient.
I think we have exhausted that point, Honourable Landers. I think you have. I think the. Yeah, that's why I say I think we've exhausted that point. The lack of consultation is the issue that is. The Honourable Mayor, if a short one, you've got a short question.
Chair, I do have a short question, but let me just start with a very short statement. The real question here is, why is it that Honourable Landers, who's a very experienced Member of Parliament, and probably the ranking Member of Parliament and representative on the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, not heard of the Johannesburg Principles? It seems to be less a failure of the lawyers who drafted the Johannesburg Principles than of the Honourable Landers himself. And I say that with respect. My question is this, sir.
Honourable Mayor, please. There's a convention in Parliament. There is a convention in Parliament which says that if you're going to attack the integrity of a member, that you should give proper notice of such so that the Honourable Member can be present and be aware of that. And I'm not going to. I think. Honourable members, we'll deal with this matter when we're in committee, because we have got work to do here. This is public hearings. We have invited a lot of visitors here. This is their day. It's not the committee's day. So, Honourable Mayor, can we get to the question now?
Thank you, Chair. My question is short. Would you summarise for us the practical effect that you believe that this piece of legislation in its current form will have on the media in South Africa?
Well, number one, it's going to make it very difficult for the media to operate as freely as it has, or as freely as it aspires to operate. That's number one. Because we will have the the threat of having to deal with classified information, and there may not be one of the other features of the bill, there may not be a notification that that information is in fact classified, because there is no obligation on a state minister or a state official to in fact disclose whether the information is classified or is not classified. And it's quite possible for that a journalist may come into contact with that type of information not knowing that it's been classified, and therefore face the prospect of a jail sentence for possessing classified information. The broad tenor is in fact to close up the channels of information. That's what this bill is doing, or it threatens to do. And that will make the conduct of journalism very much more difficult. Access to information, dissemination of information, is going to become much more difficult.
I've got a request from the Honourable Citizen. What is that request, Honourable Citizen? You want a comment? And I can see it's a quick one, so I'm going to allow it.
It's a quick comment. Also, just I know the chair will deal with this in the committee, but to make comment as well that Honourable Mayor is a new member of Parliament, is still learning rules, even of respect. I just want to say to Mr. Lowe, just going to inform you, say that we are public representatives. Part of us is to go to the broader society and consult. So if this bill, as much as you are the lucky one, because you will find it in print media, but as members of the public, as public representatives, we go to our constituencies and go and say, here's a bill. You try as much as Ms. Linda said, to speak it in our languages as well, so people can understand what is it about. So it's not proper to come and say the broader society was not consulted. I just want to clarify that point. Thank you.
And here we are. Thank you. Mr. Lowe, sorry it took longer than what was intended, but thank you very much for that presentation, and you're free to stay to listen to the other presenters. You're welcome to tea, which will come after this presentation. I've asked the next presenters, the print media of South Africa, PMSA, they've got a PowerPoint presentation to present next, and I can see they are ready to go, and we'll start with the half an hour now.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. My name is Dario Milo. I'm a partner at Webber Wenzel and appearing here on behalf of Print Media South Africa, which you will have seen from our submission, speaks for approximately 700 media titles around South Africa, and I dare say every media group in South Africa engaged in the print media industry. Mr. Chairperson, in accordance with the directive to spend 15 minutes, which I intend to keep to as best as I can, we will only highlight those aspects of the submissions that we've made in writing that we believe are worthy of further analysis and discussion. That's not to say, of course, that we concede on any of the other submissions, and we persist with all the submissions we've made in the written submissions. But what I propose to do by way of outline is briefly sketch the constitutional background that against which we must analyze these very difficult questions which arise with the bill. I then want to talk about the criminal offenses that in Print Media South Africa's submission drastically undermine media freedom, certainly not by intention, but by effect. I then want to talk about some defects of the classification regime, and in particular there, I know that this committee has heard chapter and verse about overbroad definitions. I'll touch on that, but I particularly want to focus on the speculative levels of classification that are pretty much the root of the problem of overclassification that this bill will create. With respect. And then I want to end, if time allows, with some comments on the open justice principle and access to court documents that are classified, and how this bill doesn't, in Print Media South Africa's view, strike the right balance in that regard. May I say, right at the outset, that the drafters of the bill need to be commended with respect for articulating the constitutional principles of openness and transparency eloquently by mentioning specifically the freedom of expression and access to information in the preamble and in the objectives of the bill. And we commend them for that. The difficulty, though, with the bill is that those statements and objectives don't percolate through to the nuts and bolts of the bill. And when one looks to the detail of the bill, quite frankly, the impression one is left with is that those principles are simply paid lip service, whether by design or unintentionally, by the drafters of the bill. And I say this in particular because if one has regard, for instance, to the very lofty principles mentioned in Section 6 of the bill, which says that the following principles underpin this act. State information must be available and accessible. It's the basis of a transparent, open, and democratic society, and so on. It builds knowledge and understanding, promotes creativity, education. These are all fantastic and lofty and eloquently stated principles. When one gets, though, to J, right at the bottom, which I might add is an addition into the bill compared with the last one 2 years ago, one then finds a statement which really undermines all that good work and which says paragraphs A to I are subject to the security of the Republic. With respect, one might as well not have stated the principles at all then if you have that kind of neutralizing factor at the end of the statement. So we all know the principles of openness and transparency that must be applied. May I also say that the Constitutional Court has on numerous occasions articulated the importance of media freedom, and I simply cite for you, and we've gone into great detail in our submissions on this at pages 8 to 12, but I simply cite the latest pronouncement from the Constitutional Court, which is in the case of Bruma against Minister of Social Development, and the applicant, in fact, will be presenting later today, Stefan Bruma, where the Constitutional Court said, the role of the media in a democratic society cannot be gainsaid. Its role includes informing the public about how our government is run. So the fundamental point of departure is that where we are talking about political information, political speech, which is effectively the kind of speech that this bill targets, that must be open. That must be transparent. That's the point of departure. Of course, we accept, as we must, that no right is absolute, and that national security, in principle, is a justifiable restriction on access to information and freedom of expression. And the bill is designed, quite rightly, to balance the importance of access to information against the importance of protecting national security. And we don't for one moment say, as Print Media South Africa, that the bill must be thrown into the dustbin and there's no place for a bill of this nature in our country. There clearly is a place for a bill of this nature, and it is a substantial improvement on the existing apartheid-era forms of secrecy that exist. But what we are concerned with is that getting in articulating the detail of the bill, we must make sure that balance is struck in a way that, as Sanef has submitted to you just a moment ago, achieves maximum openness and not maximum secrecy. And I fear, on behalf of Print Media South Africa, that at the moment the bill achieves maximum secrecy as opposed to maximum openness. And I'll come to why that we say that in a moment. Perhaps just one last point on that issue, and that is that it is for the government, if challenged on this bill constitution, it's for the drafters of the bill, it's for this committee to ensure that the restrictions on open justice, on freedom of expression, on access to information are legitimate, are reasonable, are justifiable. That's the duty of this committee under Section 36 of the Constitution, because I think it's absolutely clear and common cause that the bill will infringe the rights that I've spoken about. The only question is whether that infringement is justifiable. And that's a question that can only be answered when one descends to the detail of the bill. If I may then tackle the first of the three themes, specific themes I want to deal with. The first theme is that of criminal offences. Now, I've listed, both in the submission and on the slide, the criminal offences that are capable of being applied to investigative journalists, to the media. Section 18, which prohibits possession, continued possession, because you have to report and return a classified document, and I've indicated the maximum jail sentences for those offences. The espionage offence. Now, both the espionage and the hostile activity offences clearly are not meant to ensnare journalists. I mean, we accept that, and we accept the bona fides of the committee and the drafters. The difficulty is the wording is capacious, the wording is overbroad. It says if you disclose something which you ought to know, so it's a negligence test, right, which is quite anomalous in criminal liability in the first place, but it says if you disclose something which you ought to know might indirectly benefit another state or indirectly prejudice our state, you commit an offense and can be sent to jail for 25 years. Now, that is, in principle, capable of ensnaring journalists, and we suspect, we know that that's not the intention of this committee, and we simply point it out because that's the kind of provision which can lead to abuse. Of course, the provision which is most obviously in play when journalists publish public interest information that may be classified is the disclosure, the offense that prohibits disclosure of classified information. And we note there that the drafters have seen fit, for whatever reason, to substantially add to the types of information that can't be disclosed. Because it's not only that you can't disclose classified information, and I'll come in a moment to why that is a very overbroad provision, but you also can't disclose any information which is covered by Section 34 and 42 of the Access to Information Act. That's a new introduction into the bill. And it is a very radical introduction with, we would submit, very anomalous and deleterious consequences for media freedom. For example, Section 34 of PIA is about protecting the privacy of individuals and indeed even protecting the privacy of deceased individuals. Henceforth, you can't publish on pain of a criminal offense aspects of, say, a deceased individual's privacy, private information. I mean, let's take Brett Kebble's age, because that's an item of personal information. And it doesn't matter whether there's public interest or not in that publication. That's I suspect, unintended effect, by way of one example, of expanding the definition. And then we also have a new offense introduced into the bill. When I say new, it compared to the 2008 bill, and I have a copy which I can make available. And that is Section 43, the general state security offense, which once again is an entirely overbroad and deeply problematic offense, which will certainly has the ability to ensnare investigative journalists. So a number of problems with these offenses. I'll come to definitions in a moment. I've spoken about how they, for example, punish negligent publication. I've spoken about PIA being included in the disclosure offense. But the biggest difficulty that we have as Print Media South Africa, and I know that a number of other civil rights organizations have mentioned this, is that the bill doesn't include a public interest offense. Now, I've read the minutes of the committee where the bill was introduced, and it was suggested, the two propositions were suggested in the presentation of the bill before the committee. One was, well, the bill implicitly contains a public interest defense, so there's no need. With respect, that's wrong. There is no implicit public interest defense in the bill. But may I turn that on its head and say that if there is an implicit public interest defense, why not make it explicit? Because then in principle, we are all on the same page that there should be a public interest defense. But I say there certainly is not an implicit public interest defense, but if one is comfortable with such a defense, one must, for the sake of certainty, make it explicit. And that is actually the second point that was raised in the committee meetings, and that is that a public interest defense would be uncertain and overbroad. Now, we don't want to be hypocritical. We attack in our submissions the overbreadth of the national interest definition. We attack the overbreadth of the state security matter definition. We take issue with the definition of national security as it's articulated in the bill. We don't want to say we are arguing for an overbroad public interest defense. And we've proposed, and I hope that the committee members have received this, we've proposed in a marked-up version of the bill a definition of public interest which Print Media South Africa would be comfortable with. And we would offer to engage with you as the drafters, when you draft, if you are minded to include such a bill, so that we can explicate each of these provisions. Might I add, just in that regard, and you'll have the specific drafting in front of you, that all of this is not uncharted territory. We already have a public interest defense in the Access to Information Act, Section 46. We already have a public interest defense in the Films and Publications Act. For example, allowing journalists to report on hate speech without committing the offense of publishing hate speech themselves. There are public interest considerations in the Protected Disclosures Act, and I've already heard with great interest and with our support the comments made earlier today about whistleblowers and the importance of protecting whistleblowers. The New Companies Act aims at protecting whistleblowers. Defamation and privacy law is replete with examples of public interest and how the courts define those, the parameters of that concept. And of course there are also media guides and codes of conduct. So public interest is not a nebulous concept. It's a concept which has been articulated in our jurisprudence. It has been articulated overseas. And the definition we've proposed actually borrows very heavily from aspects of this jurisprudence, and indeed from the bill itself, because the bill talks about the dangers, or in fact criminalizes quite rightly, wrongly classifying information. For example, on the grounds of hiding an unlawful act, inefficiency, or an administrative error. And we've included that in the definition of public interest, because it is consistent. If you're saying to a classifier, we'll punish you if you overclassify, for example, if you're hiding government inefficiencies, then it makes sense to say, if a document that comes into the hands of the media reveals that, they should have a public interest defense to publish it. They shouldn't have this fear of liability, of criminal liability, mind you, hanging over their heads when they want to publish information, which is of crucial public interest. And one could debate some of the specifics, and we're happy to do that, but we say in principle it's a definition capable of precision, and it's one that the committee should, we would hope, give serious consideration to. I've already spoken in relation to my second theme about the classification regime, about the overbroad definitions, and again we proposed a more narrow definition. The point here is the following, and it is that it's not just the Johannesburg principles with respect, which attracted far too much attention for what they were in the exchange earlier, that articulate this. It's a fundamental principle of constitutional law in many countries around the world that you must narrowly define national security. And I take for my source here, not the Johannesburg principles, but the, if I can find it, the principles that were articulated by the African Commission on Human Rights. And what they said in 2002, so it's not 1996, it's a far more recent definition, they say, and we say these words must be heeded, that when you restrict on the basis of national security, you can only do so if there's a real risk of harm to a legitimate interest and a close causal link between the risk of harm and the expression. So this is something that the African Commission on Human Rights supports. What I would like to concentrate on, and I am skipping because I am conscious of the time, but what I am particularly interested in articulating on behalf of Print Media South Africa is how the impermissibly low levels, thresholds for classification will lead to censorship of political speech. And you'll know from the bill that when a classifier classifies as either secret, top secret, or confidential, they have to apply their mind to the tests articulated in Section 15 of the bill. What we say, and we've gone into great detail in our submissions on this at page 42, is those are speculative. If information may cause serious or irreparable harm, it can be classified as top secret. If it may endanger, it may be classified as secret. Now, the use of the word may is deeply problematic. This is not a semantic debate. In jurisdictions around the world and in our very own jurisprudence, for example, the Protection of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, we use the terminology that indicates probability, not speculative hypothetical damage. And it is, the stakes are very high. We can't get it wrong in an area which is as important as political speech. If we were having a debate about how to regulate pornography or tittle-tattle gossip about the private lives of politicians, then one might say, well, we can perhaps err on the side of over-inclusivity. But we are talking about political speech, the kind of speech that lies at the heart of democracy. We must ensure that the tests we use to classify speech that is truly harmful to national security are rigorous. And one way to ensure that rigorous assessment, we would submit, is to adopt the promotion of access to information test of could the information reasonably be expected to cause prejudice to national security, narrowly defined. And we propose a narrow definition of national security. As I say, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights supports that. There's jurisprudence in our constitutional court that supports it. And I might add that even President Obama, in the latest executive order in the United States, published in December 2009, adopts a regime for classification which adopts this test of reasonable likelihood. So it's a very minor change in wording to the bill, but it achieves quite significantly the result where there is a check and balance before there is chronic overclassification. And that's our submission on the issue of speculative harm. My last proposition, the third theme, is open justice. And here we have problems with Clause 46 of the bill. Now, I may just summarize it in a nutshell. It is that Clause 46 puts the cart before the horse. The principle of open justice says whatever document comes before a court, the basic rule is that of openness. And the Constitutional Court has said this in the Masefa case as recently as 2 years ago, in dealing with classified documents. The basic rule is one of openness, and it is for the state to justify why that should not be made available to the public. Not as Clause 46 currently does, and it does it also by including in-camera hearings and submissions that are not going to be made available to the public, all these things which are quite antithetical to democracy. What Clause 46 does is it says it goes before a court, the general rule is secrecy, and it's up to any interested party to try and persuade a judge that it ought to be made public. Actually, the test ought to be, and is, as a matter of constitutional law, the other way around. We're not saying, again, that just because a classified document comes before a court, we must all now get to see it. Don't get us wrong. But we are saying it gives another moment in our democracy for the state to justify why it is that that document ought not to be made available to the public. And if I may end simply with a quote from Judge Sachs in the Masefa case, where he said, the security police in apartheid days received greater and greater powers, ended up virtually a law unto themselves. In the paranoid worldview of those in authority, who spoke of total onslaught on South Africa, everyone was a potential enemy. Secrecy became the order of the day. The impact on the lives of the majority of citizens was devastating. Although security policy was advanced as being in the national interest, its primary goal was to safeguard the racially exclusive state and the privileged status of the white community. And he then quotes the late Deputy President Judge Mohammed, secrecy and authoritarianism have concealed the truth in little crevices of obscurity in our history. So we say, by way of summary, we agree entirely with the objectives, the preamble, and even the need for this bill. But when we articulate how we classify information, the criminal offenses that result, the levels of classification, whether we include things like commercial information, we must be particularly sensitive to the fact that we are here engaged in a debate about how far we go, where the line is drawn, where we classify political speech. And we would submit that that's a line that has to be very carefully negotiated. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, honourable members. And just before I hand over a question, Mr. Milo, something that you said, the public interest defence that you say is a necessity. I'm looking here particularly with the example that you use, the document that a particular person has in his hands now, it's revealed, as you said in your example, a crime. Just one clarity, why would you have less faith in the person taking that document to the police as opposed to him now giving it to the media publicized, because one would expect that if you did have faith in the police, that they would investigate the crime of which you are complaining. And why should you be concerned that there would be a continuous secrecy? I just wanted some clarity on that, because it seems that perhaps the assumption is not a good one, and that is that the police can't be trusted. I think that's the hidden assumption there. The police can't be trusted. So I don't know. Perhaps the example wasn't a good one. Unless you argue that, notwithstanding the fact that the police have got the right, or that the complainant should actually go to the police, notwithstanding the additional right for the recipient of the document to make it available to the media. I just want to, because after all, we are legislatures. We have to respect the structures that are out there. If there's a problem with the structures, why the structures can't be used for all that purpose, we'd like to know.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for a very important question. The answer is that the two are not mutually exclusive. There is absolutely nothing inconsistent with respecting the role of the media in exposing corruption, ferreting out nepotism, graft, and so on. And I'm using words that have been used by our judges in leading cases on media freedom. And at the same time, recognizing that the police must then do their job based on that investigation by the media, and in cooperation with the media, save for the issue of disclosure of confidential sources potentially. But there's absolutely nothing with respect, I would submit, inconsistent with the police investigating a crime that's disclosed in classified information and the media informing the public. And certainly we are not saying the police ought not to be trusted. That's not the proposition. The proposition is to say you have, if you like, a right to disclose, but it is a limited right. It is a right to disclose only to the police, or it's a right to disclose only to your member of parliament. Betrays with respect, if that is the proposition, a very narrow understanding of media freedom, because that's not what the media do, and that's not what we expect the media to do as members of the public. We want to know about a crime that's been committed by a public official now. We don't want to know about it when the police get their act together in a year's time and it goes before a criminal court. And with respect, if that was the rule, if that were to be the rule, it would lead to... we would submit quite a chilling effect on the publication of matters of public interest, which is what we want good journalism to be.
Yeah, I'm going to hear it, although I think that the argument hasn't taken me to an understanding of the fact that you persist that the media should have a parallel role in investigating crime. You know, we are creatures of statute ourselves. We come from constituencies out there. We are bound by the Constitution. The Constitution says to us, the police are those that, those are the people that should be investigating crime. And if the media out there in some capacity feel they want to be involved in following what the police is doing, that would be a different matter, I would understand, from a legislature's point of view. We cannot say as legislatures, but hold it, let's allow the media also to become investigative. I mean, if it so happens that you start to exercise rights that you're entitled to exercise, that's one matter. But would it be correct for us in a piece of legislation to say that both the police and the media should be allowed to investigate? And the problem I have is here with the presumption of innocence now, because who takes that into consideration? You sit with a document like the Consolidated Brasmo report. One doesn't know whether these are lies. It purports to be indicating that a whole lot of bad things have happened and could happen. It needs investigation. It doesn't, exposure of what is in the document is not necessarily the right way to go. It's for the police to investigate and see whether there is in fact a crime. What you are saying is that some person should use a discretion, look at the contents, decide whether there is a crime that's been committed here, and if there is one, then to either start investigating or make the document available. Now, I'm not criticizing the Beyond, just trying to make sure that as legislatures we don't set up a parallel structure of investigation, but that you shouldn't be investigating, you know, within the environment that you operate. But we need to give constitutional recognition to the structures that we have set up in our constitution, and we should let them be the authorities to deal with this thing. So, I mean, if there is a concern that that's not going to happen, then that's what I'd like to hear. These structures that you have, they are not sufficient. The public protector, the auditor general, these Chapter 9 structures are just not good enough, and we need the media to also do something. I think that's what we want to do.
Thank you very much for the follow-up. And if I may clarify, look, I'm certainly not arguing that the media should usurp the role of the police. That's not what the argument is. Just as the Chapter 9 institution, the Human Rights Commission, the Public Protector, the South African Police Service, the Intelligence Service, all have their role to play in a democracy, so too does the media. The media, known colloquially as the 40th state, has a constitutionally protected and enshrined right, but also a duty to inform the public on matters of public interest. And I mean, if one postulates, for example, the world where the media come upon an allegation of criminality, corruption, miscarriage of justice, failure to comply with a legal obligation, they cannot go to press with that. They must rather inform the public or their the police or the members of parliament. With respect, the printing presses would run dry. And then we would all read only about Britney Spears and those kinds of tittle-tattle and gossip which no one wants to encourage in a democracy. The very purpose of the media is to expose the kind of criminality that they have been exposing in very high-profile matters in the last few years. So I certainly don't see any inconsistency. And I would submit that any suggestion that the role of the media must be subsidiary to the police's investigation is not the kind of role, not the kind of media we want in our democracy. It's in fact deeply anti-democratic, I would submit, to suggest that the media should pause any investigation to wait to see what the criminal process is. It's not a question of innocence until proven guilty. If the media oversteps the bounds, there's a law of defamation that will come to the assistance of the subject of the investigation. There are media codes of conduct which can be used to police the media. And there are crimes that might be committed by the media if they overstep the bounds. But that's not the same as saying, let's throw the baby out of the bathwater. So I would suggest, and in fact it's a constitutional imperative, that all these constitutionally enshrined institutions, including the media, function in harmony with each other. We certainly don't want to undermine the role of one while respecting the role of the other.
Honourable members? Any questions? The Honourable Sedunza?
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Mr. Milo. I must say, I've went through the submission, you've done your homework. But I just have a few questions, especially now on what you said. I think it's more like what Honorable Davis has said in terms of your limits. I see you quoted Pia as well in your document. And I just want you to, are you aware that there are also certain limitations to Pia in this document? And I must say this is a democracy that will never undermine the freedom of the media. That one you must take into account. As a public representative, you live in a community. That would say to you, fortunately you're from a constituency, but that will say to you, yes, media is a very important a form of information. They act on public interest, but they overstep their bounds. Where do they get this information? And I'll also go back to the Brownsmore report, you know. And you spoke about ethics. Now I'm just going on what you have presented on ethics. I mean, it was at some stage it was fortunately represented all the media houses. So it's not a direct attack on Mail and Guardian. I know they're still coming, but one of the of the articles, the appeals of Balmol. I mean, if that document, it's divisive, and its intention was to destabilize the country. And part of, as we're drafting this bill, is to act on also national interest of the country, which includes protecting the citizens and individuals of the country. Yes, I understand you are saying that in a democracy, everything can be written. We don't want to read about Britain's fears, obviously. We also want to read about everything that is interesting. I like the gossip columns, but at some stage I find that in the same gossip columns about that information, a person's human dignity is damaged, you know, and this same constitution is still protecting the human person. It goes also the information that you get, like the Ms. Kellerman report, if you are aware of that, about the problem. She said it's a bad talk. So if it's a bad talk and you get this information that is highly classified, it has its level of classification. And how would media, because remember, as much as media is informative, it must also unite the country. It must also live according to the bounds of the constitution. And I know the other houses are still coming. Yeah, I won't address my questions, but I like your last slide about and just as well, because you must remember that as we are repealing this 1982 Act, we are also acting, that government of the regime was acting in the national interest, but of a certain a group of white community only, you know. So you must also put in your mind that this one is also acting in a broader sense. That one acted in the 1982. That's why some honorable members don't understand what happened. To us, it affected us. That's why they come in disrespective house. Thank you.
I think it's more a comment than a question. The Honorable Mania, I understand you have a question.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just say that I rather enjoy reading about Britney Spears, and I hope that none of our esteemed editors here are discouraged from reporting on her in the future. Let me ask a very short question. I wonder if you would spell out again what are the practical consequences of not including a public interest defense in this bill?
Thank you. If I may just also respond to something the Honourable Member Nduza mentioned. I think the very fact that we're able in this forum to debate the Balmol fiasco is because, or at least partly because of the ventilation of the debate in the media. In other words, you know, one mustn't always, I would submit, see the media as operating antithetically or contrary to the interests of the state and of the democracy. It's about exposing. If people are minded to undermine the country and want to destabilize democracy, and for that purpose disseminate falsehoods about presidents and public officials and so on, it's in the interest of the public that those people are exposed, and it's in the interest of the public that we can have that debate, and the media plays an important role in that, subject to anything that is truly damaging to national security being properly protected, and there's always that caveat. So that's my point on that. The point about the practical effects of not having a public interest defense, look, I think the answer is simply that, and I mean, I'm a lawyer, not a journalist, and no doubt the journalist who speaks here and Mr. Lowe already has dealt with the question on the grassroots level, because they are at the printing press. I'm a lawyer. But what I can say is that, having advised the media for a number of years, when there is a crime or a civil sanction that is in place that has the result that you could be prosecuted and sent to jail for something that you want to publish, it gives you immense pause before you are able to take that step. And the whole point about it is it creates a chilling effect, because although you might do it as a brave editor and then be prosecuted, it's a chilling effect not just on your future publications as an editor and your newspaper, but on the media generally, because it's a consequence and a very harsh penal consequence that must be weighed into the analysis as to whether or not to publish information. the benefit of explicitly demarcating the public interest defense, as we've suggested, is that it creates certainty. Because at the moment you have an overbroad, nebulous concept of national interest which creates havoc with respect. And I would not like to be a classifier of information, trying to apply my mind to how to do so with such a broad definition at play. Narrow that definition, have a definitive, as best we can, definition of public interest, and we've suggested a draft. I don't suggest it to be answer to all our prayers, but it's a starting point, I would hope. And then you are better able to balance these two very important concerns in a democracy, national security and media freedom. Thank you.
I see you look thirsty. We are getting close to tea. In fact, we are late for tea, and I am almost inclined to say there'll be no tea. But I know that will cause more trouble and Mr. Mania. Honorable Mania, did you want to say something? Do you have another question? I'll allow you that last question, Mr. Honorable Mania.
Thank you. If I understand your submission correctly, is it your contention that the bill in its current form has no prospect whatsoever of passing constitutional muster?
No, Honourable Mayor, that is not what the presenter said. Please, don't coerce a lawyer into saying something that he doesn't want to. We might get faced with a lawsuit here. That's not what the lawyer said. You want to rephrase that question? Or do you want to confirm that I'm correct, or do you want to contradict me, Mr.
Well, may I say the following, and that is that the provisions that we have highlighted in our submissions, and the ones that I've highlighted in my presentation as well, given special emphasis to, are clearly unconstitutional, in my view, and the Constitutional Court, if the debates had to get there, would strike them down. And I say this not just because of overseas jurisprudence, but because of the jurisprudence of South African courts on these issues. A court is usually loath to strike down an entire piece of legislation unless the defect fatally pollutes the whole thing. I haven't done the analysis as to whether this bill is of that nature, but I certainly can say, and our proposition for the media is that the provisions we've highlighted would be unconstitutional. I think that's the limit of what we're saying for present purposes.
But there are lawyers that have been involved in the drafting that think different. And as you know, lawyers always differ. That's why there's courts. So I don't disagree with you, nor do I agree with you. I just mark as an observation. As confident as lawyers sometimes are, they sometimes lose their cases with that very confidence. So, I'm not in a position to concede or not concede whether these things are constitutional. I think Mr. Mania's point that he wanted to make is taken, that there is concern about constitutionality of certain clauses. It was something that was raised yesterday, and it's something that we will take into consideration when dealing with deliberating on the bill. But I think we don't want to pronounce as a constitutional court here. You know, that's not the purpose. We're trying to find the balance. We look at these public hearings are for the purpose of you coming here to tell us what you see as problematic issues in the bill. And we, as the legislature, we must take these things into consideration and see how we can deal with this. And I think that's what the committee members are going to do. Honorable members, I'm going to give you, with the powers that I have, a limited time to get tea. I don't know if there are biscuits. You can get biscuits if there are. And to immediately come back to your seats so that we can start with the Mail and Guardian. If the Mail and Guardian is here, we will expect them to present immediately at 20 past 11. And we will then continue with half an hour with them. Some of your main points. You have heard the other presenters, and if you agree with them, you might just say that you agree with them. If you don't agree with them on some of these things they have said, it would be nice to hear you say so. And after the 15 minutes, the members would like to engage you with questions. So can we hand over to the mainland guardian, and after the mainland guardian, we will have the comrades of the South African Communist Party to present to us. Over to the mainland guardian, I think it is Mr. Nick Dawes. Mr. Nick Dawes.
Thank you, Chair. It's very good for me to be back in Parliament. And it's a bit strange to be up here at the microphone instead of sitting in the back row over there where I spend many hundreds of hours in taking notes, as some of you might recall. I want to ask your indulgence to tell you a brief anecdote about that background, which will illuminate, I think, why we're here and why I'm here today. But first, I want to just clarify a couple of things. As you know, the words Malin Guardian are in the program twice today. First in the form of me representing the organization, the newspaper, and second in the form of the Malin Guardian Center for Investigative Journalism, which is nicknamed Amabungani, or the Dung Beetles, because its members are dedicated into turning muck into fertilizer for democracy. Now, the center is a non-profit organization which has been established to develop investigative journalism in South Africa and the region by undertaking in-depth journalism in the public interest, by training a new cadre of investigative journalists in the country and across the continent, and also by undertaking advocacy in respect of matters pertinent to investigative journalism. It's a centre that's supported by the Mail and Guardian, among others. I know that this was canvassed in the committee earlier. I read those minutes, and the Honourable Landers suggested that I deal with the issues affecting the newspaper broadly, while my colleagues Sam Stoll and Stefan Strona deal with the crisp issues around investigative journalism. And I don't know if it's his long experience in intelligence oversight, but he clearly knew what he was thinking, and that's exactly the format we intend to follow. Of course, there will be some areas of overlap. Also, I mean, while we've made in our original submission some proposals around the specific language in the bill, I think that's really been superseded by the very detailed work and the marked-up version of the bill done by Print Media South Africa and Dario Milo. I mean, we fully support that submission and associate ourselves with it in all of its detail, so members may want to spare themselves our proposals in that regard and just take on board the express support for the ones made by Dr. Milo and Print Media South Africa. But we're here really in a slightly different capacity as working journalists, to give you an idea from the coal face or the dung face, as these guys might prefer, and to give you a chance to interrogate us directly on some of these matters, and maybe to speak about some of the practicalities that have been raised a few times, and whether you want to use classified interrogation techniques or not, which you might have learned about in the Joint Standing Committee, is up to you. So back to my little story about my own experience, very briefly. I came to work here in the press gallery during the Second Democratic Parliament, and I stayed on through the Third Democratic Parliament, and really it was the most exciting and productive period of my career as a reporter. I came here to cover the economics cluster and the associated committees, and I remember my colleague Angela Quintal, who many of you know, handing me the order paper and the committees list and sending me off into this maze of corridors to find the most important meetings of the day and to report on them. And it's really not an exaggeration to say, and I've said this to friends and colleagues and people around the world, that I was stunned and really excited by what I found. I could walk into a committee room, pick up a copy of the relevant papers, chat briefly to members around the key issues, find a chair in the corner, and listen to the discussion. And the openness didn't just extend to journalists. Here were a huge range of people. There were clever, articulate lawyers who'd interrogated all the legal nuances. There were passionate civil society advocates, people from the alliance structures, and ordinary people from poor rural areas, from the margins of our cities, and people who ordinarily would have very little access to the commanding heights of power. And over tea, there'd be conversations with government officials, parastatal officials, elected representatives, and petitioners from every walk of life. And I used to leave with a big pack of notes, tape recordings, documents, and business cards from people who were prepared to help. I think back over the financial performance of Transnet, the minutiae of local government legislation and local government accounts and performance, the remuneration of magistrates, the Road Accident Fund, successive budgets dealing with issues as diverse as defense and health. And it was and it remains open democracy in action, an extraordinary thing, and one of the really great gifts, I think, of our liberation, true informed participation in the process of governance. So, that said, we're not here today just for a bit of a contact high and a memory of that excitement, but because we think that the bill that's before you right now is a clear and present danger to open democracy in general, including the work of elected representatives like members of the committee, and the media's constitutional duties in particular. And we're here among the microphones instead of at the back because we think that the role of media is as engaged citizens, not simply as observers of processes that take place in the sphere to which we have no access. You've heard a lot of specific objections to the bill both yesterday and today. I won't belabor those at any length. I think that, again, the remarks of Boom Ray and Dr. Milo deal with a lot of that in some detail. But clearly, as legislation that seeks to regulate the disclosure of state information, and in particular, quote-unquote, sensitive information, this bill goes to the heart of our relationship as media with the state. And our concern isn't just a matter of how convenient it is or how easy it is to do our work, but in fact our constitutional mandate. And sure, we have a mandate in respect of freedom of expression, but it goes further. As the Constitutional Court has pointed out, it's the function of the press to ferret out corruption, dishonesty, and graft wherever it may occur and to expose the perpetrators. The press must reveal dishonest, mal, and inept administration. It must advance the communication between the governed and those who govern. So we've got a real responsibility to pay special attention to information that falls into the category that you could call sensitive, and that the bill, in fact, calls sensitive. But it's not just about grand corruption and criminality and the watchdog role of the media. It's also about dealing with information that is less obviously radioactive, but that illuminates the processes that are underway within organs of the state, whether those are policy debates, implementation challenges, financial performances of state entities. That kind of reporting that takes very seriously the complex and difficult work of governance is a crucial responsibility for us, and one that can only take place in conditions of openness. So, clearly access to information and information that might range across the spectrum from moderately sensitive or sensitive in the view of an official to extremely sensitive. Access to that kind of information fundamentally underpins the Constitution's foundational value. The Constitution's foundational value of responsible and accountable government, both directly in the sense of accessing information about what government is doing or not doing, and indirectly in providing the means for informed debate and political decision-making. And obviously, we understand that total openness is neither practical nor desirable. On the other hand, too much secrecy undermines the very basis of our freedom. The question is, how do we strike the balance? How does this bill strike the balance? And how does that balancing act play out in our newsrooms? And I would submit beyond our newsrooms in public discourse and the flow of information more broadly. And we think, as others have said, that the bill doesn't answer this question very coherently. And it chooses a position on the spectrum of secrecy that's not reasonable, not justifiable, and way too far over to the side of secrecy and non-disclosure. And we know that that's not its intention. That's been said before. It's worth repeating. The replacement of apartheid-era laws and the regulations around minimum information security standards with a much more coherent framework for classification and, crucially, for declassification is laudable. But as the poet T.S. Eliot used to get quoted in this building quite often, said, between the idea and the act falls the shadow, or put a bit more colloquially, the vehicle of the bill sets off in the right direction, which is the city on the hill, if you like, an appropriate democratic framework for the management of sensitive information. But somewhere along the way, it seems to drive into a ditch, and all its fine features and careful intentions become irrelevant because its wheels are spinning in the air and its passengers are stuck in their seats. as I said before, we agree with many of the other concerns raised around the bill. The broad basis of classification. Skip over some of this for time reasons. But imagine, if you like, that you're an official, maybe you're an assistant director in the Department of Public Works, and you're trying to decide whether it's appropriate to classify information relating to the water reticulation system in Kwadakuza. And you feel that possibly there could be some security threat relating to the disruption of the water system, or you feel that there is sensitive commercial information related to the tendering processes around that water reticulation system. And because you're a bureaucrat and you're nervous about getting into trouble with your superiors, you feel that this bill clearly gives you the ambit to classify that information. And imagine then that you're a resident of that area who is deeply aggrieved that they don't have adequate water and sanitation, who wants to speak to their councillor about it but finds that they get no traction, who manages to gather some information about it through associates that they may have in the neighbourhood and to take it to their elected representative or to a journalist in order to make their voices heard. If this bill is enacted in the form that it currently has, that activity will become illegal, and perhaps even councillors in the area, other elected representatives, members of this committee would find themselves in the position of committing a criminal act by virtue of receipt of that information. And indeed, a criminal act that they may not even know that they're committing because of the lack of certainty around identifying which information is classified and which is not. Similar problems arise from the wide dispersal of the ability to classify. And they're exacerbated by the lack of an independent oversight body to monitor these processes. Something that Dr. Milo touched on is the laudable illegality of classifying material simply to hide inefficiency or waste or criminality. Unfortunately, it's possible that material is classified that covers up inefficiency or criminality that didn't take place at the time of classification. So things, there may be evidence of inefficiency or criminality or corruption or poor service delivery, which is hidden from view, not because the original classifier acted with the intent to hide it, but simply because it has been hidden. And we think it's critical, just briefly to address the concerns of some members who said, well, why don't we trust the minister in his oversight? He's after all been elected with a large majority. Or as Honourable Burgess asked, why don't we trust the police? Of course, the way that our democratic architecture works is that we have a set of overlapping structures of accountability and oversight. And indeed, if we were simply to trust the minister, then there would be no need for a parliamentary committee to exercise its oversight of the minister's role. After all, he's been elected with a large majority. The idea of our democratic architecture is that you secure yourself against all the possible failures of democratic institutions by having multiple mechanisms of oversight, multiple mechanisms in which the conversations of open democracy can take place. Similar concerns arise and have been discussed at length by others about the lack of an audit trail. And indeed, that vitiates very seriously the good provisions around criminalising classification for the wrong reasons. How, after all, are you going to follow up on it if there's no audit trail? The Promotion of Access to Information Act, I'm not going to make that the center of my conversation. It's something that is easy to get distracted by. But the inclusion of all of those categories of information that are excluded from PIA under the general rubric of information that may not be published is very, very disturbing to us. It creates a kind of blanket provision that simply will be unmanageable, I think, both for bureaucrats and for ourselves. And PIA is a difficult enough act to enforce as it is. It's all very well for us as a relatively well-resourced media organization, and we have difficulty with PIA, to go to a court, spend a few hundred thousand rand, and get the information. It's a challenge for us, but it's doable. If you're a resident of a poor area who wants to find out why your council has been underperforming, why your sewage system doesn't work, why you don't have a house, and who is involved. It's a great deal easier to put you off than it is to put us off. And I think this provision worsens that situation considerably. We're also really deeply and particularly concerned about the definition of a state security matter, which essentially makes it impossible to report at all on matters concerning the state security agency and related matters. It draws a complete cloak over any of those activities. Now, clearly, we don't need to be publishing the names of South African agents operating in sensitive areas internationally. Clearly, we don't need to be publishing the cryptographic algorithms that are on radios and defense vehicles. But to prevent any oversight at all in public of those bodies, even of the most limited kind, is an extraordinary incursion into the right of the public to know and of our role in informing that right to know. And I know members have particular concerns about Brass Mole, for example, which I'm happy to talk about, which my colleagues will address in more detail. But there are other cases which one can think of, the host email saga, the abuses of the intelligence agencies that went on in the run-up to Polokwane that members will be familiar with, which clearly needed ventilation and discussion, and which I suspect many members became aware of precisely through the media. I'm burning through my time, and I want to leave a bit of space for discussion. So I want to close with a simple proposition, that there isn't a simple opposition between freedom of information and security, or between the functions of the state and the functions of the media. In fact, these are overlapping and mutually supportive roles. For example, the OECD, in its recent report on South Africa, cites interviews with security agencies like Crime Intelligence, saying, and I quote, "The Counterintelligence Desk and Financial and Cybercrime Intelligence Division of the SAP monitor media publications for information on allegations of crime and gather intelligence to substantiate the allegations." The same goes for SARS. In fact, the Standing Committee on Public Accounts in this House is likely going to be looking into overspending on World Cup tickets by parastatals because they were revealed initially in the media. And it's very possible that as sensitive financial information, that material would have been prevented from disclosure. So I think it's a very important point to make that what we do in disclosing information, perhaps what members of your constituencies do when they bring information of concern to you, is supportive of this overlapping architecture of open democracy that actually supports and enhances security. And that's why I say that I think the problems that this bill represents for the media, in a way, are the tip of the iceberg. The problems that they will represent for people like yourselves in doing the work of enforcing accountability and representing your constituents are equally serious. And I hope that at some level you'll have that in the back of your mind too when you consider the propositions in the bill as they're outlined. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Honourable members are going to engage you very soon on what is in your document and what you've said. But before they get to that point of clarity, government as custodian of lots of information. And I think one must concede that, as people have said here before, this is not government information. This is information you hold for and on behalf of the public. But within that information, can government have secrets? Is it possible for government to have secrets among that information?
I think I mentioned that, of course, government has secrets among that information. I think it would be very unfortunate if we let this conversation get derailed by a perception that we think that government has no secrets. I mentioned cryptographic algorithms, matters of clear national security that are secrets. Clearly, there are secrets in the diplomatic trade as well. I mean, I don't think that government wants highly sensitive cables from embassies to Durko to be handed out to all and sundry. So I think it's it's clear that government has secrets. The question is, what's the appropriateness of the mechanisms for protection of those secrets, and what's the appropriateness of the language that's drawn up around deciding where that line lies? And is it a language of absolutely minimal disclosure, so that, for example, the bill says where disclosure may tend to prejudice the national interest. It could be a tiny, tiny percentage of risk rather than a real substantial apprehension of harm that's coming into play there. So I think that's really the question. It's not a broad philosophical question about whether government can have any secrets at all.
I think I'm glad. I think we have found some common ground here that government can have secrets. I think where we will want clarity and where the debate really is, who determines what is a secret and, you know, how far can you go, because the examples you use are clearly on the one side and clearly one can identify that as secrets, and as one comes closer to the grey area, the debate starts to get a bit hot and you start to become a bit nervous that there's too much, there's a lack of transparency in it. But as long as I think we move from an understanding, you know, that there be no misconception out there in the media that the government has got secrets, and it's not because it wants to have secrets. It's just the way governments work. They have secrets, and there's an obligation on government to protect them. I think the debate is we need to find out just which ones can be protected and how to go about protecting them. Honourable members, I've got some concessions here. I saw the Honourable Sedunza first and then the Honourable Mania. Am I recognizing the Honourable Ngabadali as third? Second? Can I have the Honourable?
Thank you. I call him Comrade Nick. Mr. Dog, I don't worry, I won't crucify you. I believe constitutionally media is part of us, and it's the same government that ensures that there's media freedom. And I also believe that, my first question to you, would you believe that our media is patriotic? I know you'll answer, is it patriotic? Because as government, we've got the responsibility to show that human dignity is still maintained. Fortunately, in your presentation, point 12, you say partly, then you say it promotes human dignity. Don't you think that partly, as it's called human dignity, media is supposed to assist us on that? Because you remember information, as you say, it's classified. And information of somebody is very important. Imagine your information are lying around all over, everybody knowing about you, your bank balance, how many liver transplants do you have. Do you think that is that promoting human dignity? Because that's still information. And the state is also trying to promote to protect its citizens with that, because we are also blight by the constitution, because everyone is relying on constitution. Secondly, the same constitution is saying that we must also promote our culture. The one has got a right to culture, to practice his culture or her culture at any level. You would find that some information that is written to us, to me as an African person, I don't speak about, I can't speak about Honorable Kutse because he's much older than me. I cannot say some of the things about him as much as we are colleagues, you know. So I find it very disturbing. But lastly, there's this fear as if we are trying to close everything. No, it's not. Media is still part of our society, and we still believe it plays a role. It's just another member. I wanted to raise this in Khoisan. I have a question from my constituency when I was trying to educate them about this bill. What thing is Khoisan? Ungandoni na imibuzo njalo ihleleleka kurhulumente. Kutheni ungakhe kubhalwe into entle ngurhulumente, zihlala zimbi. I will translate now. Here is it, I'm reading, I'm not quoting out of context. It's saying, our media, we enjoy their freedom, that the information that they give us.
But why is it that information, one-sided, always attacking the government, not coming to me? Information as well, you say you expose corruption. I had a case in my constituency whereby a woman was assaulted by a member of a police force. Yes, I assisted to open the case. When I was calling all these media houses, I, as a public rep, now exposing my own citizen, it was not newsworthy, not headlines enough, but the Brown Mole report, which divides the country, is newsworthy. So I want to understand what type of information do you also? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for some very good questions. I mean, I can have a very long conversation with you about these things. And maybe we should have some of the conversation offline. But let me try and answer you as crisply as I can. Is media patriotic? I think absolutely that we are. If you saw the excitement of our media during the World Cup and the extent to which it absolutely dominated everything we did, you can see the enthusiasm with which the media grasped the chance at telling a mostly quite simple and very exciting positive story. But even in a more complex way, when we do the work that seems more negative or more challenging, I think absolutely that that's our patriotic duty and our role. I don't think people enjoy attracting criticism, having hard conversations on the phone, being taken to court, etc. But we really do view it as a vocation. And as our duty. So that's the first answer. And I don't know if that will inform your broader discussion on the specifics of the bill, but that's very much my view. The question of human dignity, I think, is a fascinating one and one that needs much more elaboration in our law and our thinking about the way the press works, the way our culture works, etc. But I'll say the following thing. I think, again, that the opposition between freedom of speech and human dignity is a false opposition. I think being able to speak my mind is part of my dignity as a human being. And I believe there's constitutional court jurisprudence to that effect, in fact. I also think that there are appropriate limitations on access to personal information, much of which is held by the state, much of which is held by private corporations, and often not very well looked after. The question is, there may be circumstances under which it's appropriate to disclose that information, but they clearly need to be delineated. I think that's work that's been done in the committee dealing with the with protection of personal information bill. It's important work and work that we will weigh in on. The question of culture and giving offense is a deeply complex one, and it's one that our whole society is trying to figure out how to deal with. And I think one of the things about the way that we live with each other in this country that's exciting and thrilling is that these big differences bump up against each other and bash into each other, and they make all kinds of sparks. And actually, that's why I want to live here and why I don't want to live in Canada or New Zealand or somewhere more homogenous, because I think that living with those contradictions is what makes our culture rich. And I hope that in the media we find ways to give expression to that richness. Slightly off the point, but it's a precious issue to me. We don't think you're trying to close everything off and that's your intention. I mentioned that I thought that the journey of the bill was to the city on the hill, but that the vehicle somehow got stuck in a ditch on the way. I think your assault case story is very interesting. In fact, if this bill were to come into effect, and I had to weigh up in my mind, am I going to publish Braz Mole, or am I going to publish Honourable Sunduza's story about the way that police conduct themselves in her constituency? And perhaps there's classified information involved there because it relates to the investigation. I've got to say to myself, okay, what's the risk of publishing this? Here's a story that affects the very fabric of the state, high politics that absolutely everyone is going to care about, and here's a story about a poor woman in a poor area, far away. Okay, I'm going to get taken to court, I'm going to spend millions of rands, this is going to be tough. Okay, I think I'll go with Braz Mole. All right? Whereas if I know that I can publish that information and exercise freedom of expression and oversight of the police without those difficulties, I'm much more likely to do so. So I think the bill actually makes your problem worse in that regard.
The Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned that you have spent many years working in Parliament and have long experience in Parliament. And at the same time, you alluded in your presentation to the fact that you thought that there could be grave consequences of this bill for Parliament and its functioning. And I wonder if you could expand on that point.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a whole range of different kinds of work that gets done in this building and gets done by members. And some of it is this kind of work, legislative drafting work, and some of it is oversight work and the representing of constituencies. And I know that members from all parties are recipients of sensitive information from their constituents, whether it's information around a rape and assault by a police officer, information around tenders, information around defence-related matters, a whole spectrum of matters. And I think it's crucially part of the duty of members of this Parliament to be in receipt of that kind of information, to be trusted by those who've elected them, and to have channels to give effect to their mandate as public representatives by bringing that information to light. And this House has all kinds of procedures and rules for dealing with that, which allow it to be rigorously handled. Now, if you are going to find yourselves staring down the barrel of 5 years in jail, 10 years in jail, 25 years in jail, when you're in receipt of information from your constituents, I think that you're going to have very serious pause before you actually carry out your democratic mandate. And I'd be very sad and disappointed to see that happen to this institution.
Again, it's a question, but not a question. It's a question in the sense that I would love the family of media to go home and really think about their contribution as individuals living in South Africa when we are designing such things and when we are working to actually bring up our country to its best. Your own contribution as a family of media. Since yesterday, I have listened from so many media names, the Dlaminis, the Nobles, in media terminology. Is it that much difficult for media to have a family, and then when they come to present in issues of building the country, they come as a collective that has met before coming here? Because instead of making some of us to see media as the asset of the nation, it becomes different pockets of business style. This business, it has got to say what they are doing and how. And it starts from there to begin to say, do I trust this family? I'd rather go to that one. Do I trust this one? I'd rather go to that one. Because, guys, we are part of this country. Before you go to your office called Mailing Garden, you are part of this country. When your own community is running meetings of your own community where you stay, do you attend? Do you go there and listen with you as part of that community? Because if in media, press, media was going to be a very valuable tool. But I get the impression that you are a media person once you are in your office. Back home, there is nothing media about you. There is nothing South African about you. That's why I'm saying I don't really expect 100% response. This is a question of conscience. When we were still being arrested, and some of us, actually most of us, there was Maiden Garden. There's still Maiden Garden. But I'm not sure which one was that one, which one is this one. I can talk to you one day about that. But there are many Maiden Garden now. When I buy the Maiden Garden, I found something else, which if the police didn't take those copies of Maiden Garden, I was going to show you the Maiden Garden and the Maiden Garden and the Maiden Garden. Oh, yeah, no, Red, just belong to where you stay. Listen, without being called by police to come and take photos, listen from where your kids are in the vicinity. It would be nice. I'm looking forward. I do run a particular portfolio. Looking forward to meet with media as a media family, not as business collective and competition type of approach. Because if it's going to be a tool of communication, let it be. in building, in destroying, in reconstruction, in doing whatever, let it be. Thank you.
As they would have said in the days of the struggle, are you with the struggle or are you against the struggle, sir? I mean, that's what the honourable member is saying, you know. The media has seemed to have created a institution of its own that is not with the people and not understanding the people. I don't think the honourable member has been dishonest. I think the honourable member is really talking about an experience that she's gone through, particularly with the Malian Guardian. And she's asking you, are you the same Malian Guardian that existed in the time when you were needed to say something? It appears you didn't say. You can have a comment. You don't have to if you don't want to.
That's exactly why we are here as the Malian Guardian. I mean, I think there were perhaps two contending lines of thought in the comments, and the one was, why have we come here alone rather than as a group of media? And I think partly that's because there is no one media. There are certainly our interests that we share, but we're a diverse group of people and a diverse group of publications. And we've come here partly because while Dr. Milo has presented very ably an analysis of some of the key issues of the bill, we thought it might be helpful for the committee to ask questions about our working practices, about what happens in our newsrooms, and indeed the kinds of difficult questions that you've asked me now about who we are and where we are. I mean, I'm very upset that you assume that when I go home I'm not South African anymore. I was just trying to explain how fundamentally I'm here and I'm staying here, and we as the Malian Guardian are here because we are thrilled by being South African and by all the complexities of this emergent democracy that we occupy. And I'd love to have a personal discussion with you or a broader discussion about the history of the Malian Guardian. What I'll say very briefly, because it's been raised by both you and the Chair, is that our commitment in the 1980s, and we're 25 years old now, as a campaigning anti-apartheid voice, was to principles of freedom, justice, and equality. And those principles are exactly the same. They find expression in different ways, but ultimately what we're interested in as a newspaper is creating a society that is more equal, that is more happy, where resources are shared in the most equitable and most efficient manner, and where we're able to really realize the dreams that we all had at that time in the 1980s when we were a scrappy little campaigning newspaper. You know, my father used to bring it home on a Friday. It was a thrill to see in a white suburban lounge that, you know, resistance was real and that there were communities of resistance and that there were things one could associate oneself with. I think those values are still very much alive in what we're trying to do now. Of course, we get it wrong sometimes, but that's just perhaps like the bill, that is the impetus behind everything that we do.
Honourable members, we are coming close to the end of the session, but I see, let me recognise the Honourable Fichler first, and you want to take up a follow-up, Honourable Sedunza? Let's hear the Honourable Fichler first.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair. Yeah, in fact, I'm just again lingering on this question of newsworthiness. You know, why we have this attitude towards media is because the good things that are done by the government seemingly are not newsworthy. I'll give an example. You know, there was a huge project in Port Elizabeth, billions of them, that of Kuha. Now, what we did, we had to make a motion here in Parliament in order to address the people out there to know what is happening there, what are the gains for the Eastern Cape, what are the gains for South Africa. But the media was silent about that. That's why we usually say that good things that are being done by the government, seemingly they are not newsworthy. It's newsworthy when it is negative towards the government. That is the problem that faces us.
Very briefly, I would point out that the newspapers of the past 6 weeks, which have been full of positive things that the government has been doing, whether it's the efficiency of the World Cup courts, the success of the infrastructure program. I know that I've written many positive things myself about good choices made in this House, whether there are new laws, budgetary allocations, etc. I mean, I might disagree with you personally about whether Kucho was a good thing or not, but I think that if you show most journalists in this country something that they can celebrate that's substantive about the good work that's being done by government and things to be excited about as South Africans, we'll seize it. And I think that the coverage during the World Cup period is testimony to that.
Honourable
Sedunza,
did you have a query here?
The last one, I just read something here quickly. And so don't worry about these questions, also are part of the bill because we want to understand at what level. Maybe you are worried now, we are attacking me. Don't worry, Million Guardian, I'm getting my copy tomorrow, don't worry. It just makes us understand as well what is your broader thinking as a committee. It forms part of the bill. I know maybe you're asking, why are they asking me those questions? It's not to interrogate, and none of you as well. Even I saw Sanef when they were asking, my question is, okay, you've got a suggested criteria as well. I attest to that and I agree. But part of what the bill is doing, it's to also deal with, to deal with information peddlers. And I hope you don't use them as Million Gardner. Do you have a problem with government legislating such law? Or I understand you've raised a lot of concerns about the level of confidentiality. Even I can see on recommendation 3, we accept those recommendations. But you understand what angle am I getting to? Because you have a problem with legislating such, because you know.
I don't think that there's any disagreement between us that there are people around who use information and disinformation for nefarious purposes. The question that I would ask the drafters and the committee is how conceivably you legislate against that and what the possible impacts of that legislation are for people across the democratic spectrum, whether they are journalists or members of parliament or members of the intelligence services who deal with people who could be described as information peddlers on an ongoing basis as part of the core of their work. And so I think the question would be, when does one become an information peddler? When does the intention appropriately to share information become illegal? And I would question whether it's actually possible to legislate against it in the way that the bill envisages. I think there are lots of other laws that we have that can deal with it, but my concern is that in capturing it in the way that the bill has, you're going to capture a lot of other people. It might even be a person in your home constituency who gathered together information about someone who'd been abused and who had a few pieces of false information mixed in with the correct information, and would thus fall foul of the law. I mean, I think that's a very worrying prospect. So I think we have to be alive to the difficulty of implementation there.
Before you go, I'm going to end. Before you go, I just wanted to get clarity. You've got a very vivid set out here on page 26 of your annexure A. When you are raising the public interest defense and you say no person is guilty of an offense under those sections, a person acts in the public interest, and you start to then define or give various sub-clauses as to what you consider to be in the public interest. The question is just, is this perhaps your experience, these, or have you taken this from another jurisdiction?
I think it's a comment.
Sure, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, ultimately, I would cede the ground of the specifics of that to Dr. Mulo's presentation, which I think captures most of it. But our own experience, and if you like, the kind of natural justice of our thinking on these things, arises out of the kinds of instances that people have brought to us, and our own efforts to deal with them. I think they are, though, quite well captured in some of the international jurisprudence. And I think that the way that the Print Media South Africa submission sums them up really gets at that. So it ranges from hypocrisy, for example, in public life, through to gross corruption or maladministration. But the fact that the scale is so wide really attests to the texture of experience in newsrooms. So people will come to us offended that a public official, for example, or a CEO of a company who purports to be a paragon of virtue, in fact, conducts themselves very differently on issues that matter, all the way through to finding out that someone has stolen money or skewed a tender or assaulted a powerless individual.
It doesn't come from one jurisdiction. It's a combination of your own thinking and...
That's right.
And some things might have taken from decisions.
But I think it is quite well... captured in, for example, the Canadian law, the New Zealand law, and some of the other examples that we refer to.
Honourable members, I think that's it. We're going to thank you very much, Mr. Dawes, for your presentation, and you must always, when you come to these presentations, be prepared. The members are sometimes quite determined to get to the bottom of the thinking, not necessarily the words, but the thinking behind the words, and I think you experienced that today, you know. And you shouldn't be offended.
I wouldn't want it any other way. I enjoy it. Thank you.
Now we are going to go over to the Communist Party, the comrades from the Communist Party, and they are going to take us into lunch. After that, this presentation from the Communist Party, we would go to lunch. You can just introduce yourself, comrades, and then we will have a half an hour with you, 15 minutes on your presentation, and the other 15 minutes, the members would like to engage.
Thanks, Chairperson. My name is Crosby Moni. I'm a member of the Central Committee of the South African Communist Party. I am together with Mhlekwa Nxumalo, who is Chief of Campaigns and Deployment in the South African Communist Party. Quickly and briefly, our presentation goes thus. The Constitution of the Republic of South Africa gives a considerable attention on national security through a system of organs of the state. The executive and parliament are empowered to deal with the concept. In doing so, the Constitution also recognizes that when dealing with matters of national security, these must be pursued in compliance with the law, including international law. Our assessment as the South African Communist Party is that the South African state remains vulnerable to all kinds of internal and external attacks and threats from its enemies. Not everyone is happy about our democracy, the administration of President Zuma, including our relationship with countries like Cuba, Venezuela, and many others. After 16 years of democracy, South Africa still refers to an act of 1982, which was never meant to protect the national interests, but it was meant to protect the minority apartheid regime of whites only. Organizations like South African Communist Party and the African National Congress were regarded as terrorist organizations. So all available resources were invested to defend the minority, was on the other hand marginalizing the majority in the country. Some of these tendencies still exist today and find representation even in parliament, business, and the NGO sector, for an example. The South African Communist Party welcomes the bill with an understanding that it will help the country to effectively protect important and valuable information in the hands of the state within the context of our democratic state. We are convinced that this is an important step that Parliament is taking, noting what happened here in previous years and also in other African countries. It is our view that whilst there is a need for openness in the state, there is equally a need to protect some of the state information that truly requires protection, which is an important aspect of the security of the Republic. So the bill, we hope, will be able to give a balance between the concept of classified information and transparency without compromising national security and or the national interest. We were concerned as the SACP of previous developments such as the special browse mole consolidated report alleging that President Zuma was involved in a conspiracy which was a threat to the sovereignty and integrity of the South African state. We were satisfied about the conclusion reached by Parliament that the report had a potential of creating civil war and was a result of information peddlers working in the Directorate for Special Operations. Also, there are various structures and institutions in other countries who continue to engage in acts of extortion and espionage to obstruct the work of government. This is done as a result of the level of access to state information through their surrogate public servants, who are aware that there are no regulations or statutes that criminalize the disclosure of state information without authority. In essence, our current systems are so weak and lack seriously on the aspect of protection that makes criminals to prey easily on our state system, siphoning state resources which are supposed to benefit the people. We have noted and partly agree with comments from other organizations like COSATU and other structures or institutions which specifically object to closed trust, which may create serious challenges regarding state entities avoiding to disclose information relating to tenders and other aspects of their business if they choose not to do so. Parliament should therefore give concrete answers on how the bill will be able to assist Parliament to monitor state entities. We support the proposed penalties for offenders and we hope it will be sending a strong message for people to start respecting South Africa as a country. The above is just a few points that we thought needed to be raised as giving support to the bill, whilst on the other hand raising some critical points we think should be responded to by the committee. Thank you once more for the opportunity to make this short presentation on behalf of the South African Communist Party. We hope the formal processes of Parliament will be able to process the bill within the stipulated time. We thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable members, the Honourable Sidinza, and then the Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the presenters from the South African Communist Party. My question is on point 9 on the presentation number 9. Well, I just need clarity where they say they object clause 12 and if I check, is it about the method of I want to capture that on the method of information. Because are they saying, so I can understand, if a person does not want to disclose the tenders, they must have the right not to do so. I just want to be on path. Yeah.
And secondly, are they aware that the constitution obliges us as parliamentarians, the executive, to own national security and to protect the people of South Africa? So would we not untruthful if we don't do that, because that's why this bill is part of our executive action that we must take. Thank you.
You. Thanks, Chair. Our understanding is that the clause that we're talking about is about commerce. And then commerce means competition. There is a time when you would be disclosing information to your competitors, and then there would be objections by those who owned or who have created that type of information. What we are saying is that the disclosure,
the confidentiality.
The confidentiality should not be used in order to create an obstacle to the public getting information from state entities. And then we say those entities are supposed to be creating benefits for the public, and therefore the public should be allowed to know whatever they should be knowing. And then we say, ultimately, but all these interests should be balanced with state security and the national interest.
The Honorable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. The presenter in the submission mentioned siphoning off of state resources. I wonder if the presenter could tell us whether, in his view, the revelations in the media concerning Dr. Bladen's Monday's big spending on vehicles and hotels, whether that information should be protected or exposed, and whether indeed he believes whether revealing that information was in the national interest.
Before you answer, Honourable Member. Honourable Presenter. Honourable Mania, I don't think it is the presenter's case that information that you are referring to, is not said that here that information should be protected. So I'm not sure whether the question is fair. The information was disclosed. It was that type of information that was not protected, was not classified. Whether it was correct, false or not, I don't think it's an issue. I'm just trying to understand why is it that you expect this presenter to answer that question. Can you just motivate it? Because I will allow it if you can. At the moment, it appears to be an unfair question.
Thank you, Chair. Well, it would seem to me that one of the consequences of the bill in this current form could be, in fact, to cause that kind of information not to be disclosed. And so it seems to me a pertinent case and relevant. But I will allow you, obviously, respect your judgment in this regard, Chair.
Now, I don't, with respect, Honourable Member, I give the presenter an opportunity if they want to answer, but it seems that you've been, the presenter, it's not their case that information should be protected. They talk in general terms. They're concerned about that information that those acts that undermine the state, and I don't think they were specific in the fact that there might be important people in South Africa that may or may not behave in a certain way. I think the media is always going to be saying something about that, and as you say, they have said something, but I don't think I want to create the impression to these presenters that is in fact what they said, because I don't think they've said that. If the presenters don't want to answer it, I will not force them to answer it.
Chairperson, the question becomes difficult in the sense that we are talking classification or declassification of what is already in the public domain. It's just like saying to somebody, you are a fool or you are stupid. When that person protests, you say, I withdraw. understood. I think that is what I need to say.
Honourable members, questions? Got another question, Honourable Mania? While the Honourable members are thinking, perhaps the Mr. Moni, you want to tell us, because what one of the things that the bill is addressing is the harm that information peddlers have caused this country. And you do raise it in your presentation, somewhat really just, you know, casually. And we do know from the whole experience that your organization did have some of the negative consequences imposed on it as a result of the leaking of that consolidated Brasmol report that you also mentioned in your presentation. Perhaps you can share with us some of the experiences that you had to go through, or if you know of the experiences that people have to suffer as a consequence of the behavior of information peddlers. We have had, as a committee, a presentation from the Minister on information peddlers, but I think there are a number of people present here today that perhaps just see information peddlers as a name and not perhaps familiar with the type of havoc that they have been creating, and perhaps you want to share some of that experiences with us if there are any.
Somewhere in the late 1990s, it was casually reported in the newspapers, or let me say in the media, that three individuals wanted to unseat the president of the African National Congress. And those three individuals had to deal with issues that were rising in their families in the first instance, and issues that were rising in their organizations secondly. And then the third issue was that they had to deal with a public that was not sure whether to be favorable to them or to be hostile. Then somewhere along the line, the public was told that, no, that was not true. What if certain people had killed those three individuals during the time when it was not clear to whether that was true or not true? Again, this Brasmol thing nearly created chaos in the country, because it must be understood that some of our people follow individuals and other people, and some of our people follow principles and policies of organizations. So to simply speak about an individual who is high up, carelessly like that, JZ is planning to do this and that against the state, we regard that as highly and highly irresponsible, irrespective of who is publishing that. Particularly when in the final analysis it is found to be untrue. I think that is enough, Chair, to mitigate our case.
Thank you. Honourable members? Comrade Mondi, it seems that my members are becoming hungry now, and they're not interested in asking you any questions. Honourable members, it seems that we have come to the end of the session, and we are going to break for a period of lunch, which starts at 12:45. We will be seated here by 1:25, and we will immediately then receive a presentation from the National Archive and Record Services of South Africa, and we are looking forward to meeting them because we've got lots of questions for them. So please do not be late. After that, we will